Call to order the House Interim Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Effectiveness. It's Friday, January 15th, 2 o'clock. Good afternoon. We have a full agenda today. So first off, we're going to introduce our committee measures. And Victoria, who's our new committee administrator, welcome.
Thank you.
And do you want to give us a quick overview of each of those bills? And I think then I will take a motion.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. The LCs before you, which are listed on all of us, are LC 107, which is a joint resolution amending the Oregon Constitution to clarify that Section 6, Article 11, prohibition against state ownership of stock does not apply to public universities. LC 109, relating to measures referred by the Legislative Assembly, is actually a placeholder for the referral of the constitutional amendment discussed above. LC 214 relating to courthouses allows a county approved to receive funds for a courthouse from the Oregon Courthouse Capital Construction and Improvement Fund to impose a surcharge on circuit court fees not to exceed 15% of the fee and or a surcharge on fines imposed for boating, parking, and traffic violations not to exceed $5 to be deposited into the fund and used for capital improvements to the county courthouse. Circuit court fee surcharges will be set by the county commissioners in consultation with the presiding judge for the judicial district, and boating, parking, and traffic fine surcharges are to be set by order of the presiding judge with approval of the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court.
Wonderful. With that, I will entertain a motion on the introduction of committee measures.
Madam Chair,
Madam Chair, I move that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills: LC 107, dated January 14th, 2016; LC 109, dated January 5th, 2016; and LC 214, dated January 14th, 2016.
Representative Bueller moves that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills: LC 107, dated January 14th of 16; LC 109, dated January 5th of 16; LC 214, dated January 14th of 16. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, just as a reminder that a vote to introduce the committee bill is not an indication of support for the policy, but just rather converting it from a legislative concept into a measure in order that it may be referred to a committee for consideration. And just as a note, I don't expect any of these bills to actually be coming to our committee for a vote, so or through a referral. So one more call. Is there any discussion? That was just a hello. Happy New Year.
Yeah.
All right. Seeing none, the measures are introduced as committee bills. Is there any objection?
Correct.
Is there any objection? Seeing none, the measures are introduced as committee bills. Okay, with that, we have three informational meetings today, and all of them have a couple of panels, so we're going to want to move through pretty quickly. Again, these are informational meetings, so we'll be using invited testimony only. Also, we're certainly considering all three of these concepts in the upcoming legislative session, so you should certainly feel free to ask questions. I would just ask you to all keep in mind that we will obviously see all of these concepts again when we're actually looking at the bills. So to still keep an eye a little bit on time, and mostly this is for getting these concepts out so we can begin thinking about them before we have to actually consider the bills. So with that, I'm going to open an informational meeting on liability limits for wrongful death actions. And with that, I'm going to call. Do I need to gavel that? And with that, I'm going to call up our first panel, which is Patrick Block and Catherine Clark. And you may please introduce yourself for the record and then proceed in whichever order you prefer.
I'm Patrick Block. I'm an attorney and a longtime member of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association.
I'm Catherine Clark. I'm also an attorney. I practice primarily appellate work,
I'm also a member of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association, and I've litigated a number of issues surrounding this cap.
Great. And if how's the sound picking up for both of them? Maybe, Catherine, if you want to bring the mic a little bit, but then still keep about a good 8 inches between your mouth and the microphone, but you both can have one in front of you. Okay, great. Well, thank you for the introduction, and go ahead and begin your testimony.
Okay. I'm going to start out, and what we're here about is raising the non-economic damages cap on wrongful death cases from $500,000 up to $1.5 million. And this, what I was given as the proposed bill, is identical to a bill passed by the House in 2009 by a vote of 55-4. It's raising the cap to $1.5 million and then adding a COLA for the future. And the cap was originally passed in 1987, and it hasn't been changed in 29 years. And if you take into consideration just the amount of inflation, it would be over $1 million today already. I also wanted to point out that in the last 15 years, Oregon voters have voted down caps on two occasions, and this particular law only applies now to wrongful death cases because it's been determined to be unconstitutional in every other type of injury case. So that's the only thing that's capped. I wanted to point out that having this cap at $500,000 is discriminatory against those who are seniors, those with disabilities, those that are stay-at-home parents, because their economic loss is severely limited, very little. And so the amount that their lives end up being worth is $500,000 if you get to a jury. And with respect to insurance carriers, they're never going to pay the $500 because they know that if they pay less, $300, $400, that the litigation costs are going to eat up the rest of it anyways, and so you never even get to the cap. I wanted to give one example of a case that deals with somebody with a low economic value as far as their economic losses, as you can prove, somebody working at a very low wage. He was working, his name was Andrew Lane, he was 22 years old, and he was working with his grandfather for a business that cleaned roofs and sides of houses with a pressure washer, and the boss refused to let them use the bathroom in the houses that they worked at and refused to give them any type of a porta potty to use, so they had to use a 5-gallon bucket and go in the back of the truck that was enclosed, and the pressure washer was improperly vented, and so it filled with carbon monoxide when Andrew was in there, and he was asphyxiated, and his grandfather found him in there when he went to go get a tool. And to this day, to my understanding, the boss has never apologized to the family whatsoever. So in that case, his claim is limited to $500,000 plus whatever wages he would have made for the remainder of his life minus the consumption of what he would have consumed. And so it's right for a jury to make that determination rather than just cap it at $500,000 because it's a wrongful death case, and if he was alive, there'd be no cap at all. So what we're asking is to raise that, not eliminate it, to $1.5 million, which would be just.
I'd like to add to that just slightly. He's already covered part of the material I was planning to cover. But you know, in law school, I first heard the phrase that it was better to kill your victim than to maim him. And the reason for that was because at one time, wrongful death, they were having trouble recognizing a death action. So that if the person died, there was no recovery. Yes, that happened in a number of cases. And So it was better to kill your victim than to maim him. If you killed him, you'd go scot-free. Now, statutorily, they took over that, and wrongful death actions came into being, and then after a time, they quit limiting the damages. It used to be that you'd only get economic losses way back when. And so for a long period of time, it was no longer true that it was better to kill than to maim your victim. But it's true again now. And that's what we want to correct eventually, so that they're on an equality. At the least, we would like to see it increase to $1.5 million with a cost of living increase. The impact, I think, that he's already mentioned on the poor, on the elder, families who lose an elderly person, a stay-at-home person, and children And I'd like to give two examples. You know, the juries do not run amok on these things. They really do not. The first example that I have was where the cap was applied and we contested it, was the case of the death of a 10-month-old child because of a runaway truck with bad brakes, who was speeding and lost his brakes and rear-ended a semi on the Siskiyou Pass. The child died. The parents were awarded $100,000 in economic loss for the wrongful death and $1.5 million for their non-economic, for the loss of the society and companionship of this child that was removed so violently from them. I also was involved in a case of a 19-year-old girl, failure to diagnose a systemic bacterial infection, and she died rather miserably and quite suddenly. And in that case, the jury awarded $1 million, $500,000 for each parent, as their loss of society and their loss of the society and companionship of the child. Again, not an unreasonable amount. Both of those sums would have been covered by this cap that we're proposing now. And so I'd like to see this this occur, if it could, and put the wrongful death action on a better equality with a personal injury action.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Representative Hoyle.
Thank you for your testimony. So if does the jury know that the cap is in place when they make the determination?
No. The jury is not told. The cap is applied after the fact. It only comes into effect if the verdict exceeds the amount of the cap, and then the court will reduce it to the capped amount. So the jury is never told. And the jury does their job of evaluating the compensation that is appropriate for the particular case in front of them.
Follow-up?
So the cap comes into play. The jury says this is of X value. $1 million, $1.5 million, and then the cap comes into play, so the maximum that can be paid out is, I just want to, because this isn't my background, I just want to figure this out. So the max they can get paid out is $500,000, so who bears the cost of that, of the rest of that judgment?
The family.
It's the family and the victims.
The judgment is entered in the reduced amount, so the family bears the remainder of the loss without compensation.
Representative Stark.
Thank you, Chair. I have a couple questions, but a follow-up on that. Do we know the numbers on how often juries have attempted to award over the cap, and what the normal, out of those, what are they usually suggesting and what amounts and so forth?
I don't think we have an accurate survey. I will tell you that I've been waiting for another case to come. And I'm still waiting, and I've been waiting for months now, because I think that the attitude we've all received indications that the Supreme Court may be willing to reconsider the constitutional question, and I have been waiting for the case to come up, and it has not. So I'm here to say it isn't very frequent that a jury awards more than $500,000, but it does happen.
With the $500,000, how are we aligned as far as what are the other Western states doing? I don't really care that much about New York, but what are the other states doing? How do we align with that, and what sort of numbers are we seeing there?
I don't know the answer to that question. There are states that don't have any cap at all. California has a cap, but it's only a
$250.
But that's on medical negligence.
Correct.
Yes, just simply medical negligence. So it's one carve out of a particular kind of claim. It wouldn't have applied, for instance, to the case involving the child in the runaway truck. So I'm not sure what the status is. During that wave of tort reform that ended up with our cap on non-economic damages here in Oregon, there were a lot of states that played around with this concept. There were a number that refused. And I'm not sure how the stats actually work out.
There's 13 states that have no cap at all, including the state of Washington. I know that. But I don't know whether 500 is the norm or 1.5 or what it is in between. On the states that have a cap.
I think I have two more
follow
questions.
Up. Yeah, go ahead, and you can ask both of them.
You're saying you don't know at the moment. I would appreciate seeing the numbers on, you know, what are the other states doing? And you mentioned 13 that don't have a cap. I'd enjoy seeing how often has that gone above 100 or 500,000 in those uncapped states? How often does it go? What percentage of the time is it over 500,000? To really show that there's a true need. I'm also interested, when there's a settlement, how is that? So if they say 700,000, 500, it's capped at 500. What is the norm on that 500,000? How it actually gets split up? Who receives what out of that 500?
You mean in a death case, who gets the money?
On the non-economic, yeah. So when it's between, state attorneys, the victim, all across the board, how is that normally split?
Well, there's a statute that...
I don't know it, so if you'll tell me.
There's a statute under Oregon law that delineates who the beneficiaries are of a wrongful death estate. So you open an estate, you have a personal representative, and it's the spouse, the parents, and the children and the stepchildren of the decedent who are the beneficiaries. And they agree on how they're going to split whatever proceeds there are, and if not, then there's a hearing before a judge, and a judge makes a determination of the relationship of the decedent with the various beneficiaries and makes an allocation of the amount of money that goes to each one.
And are there...
The state does not take anything.
The state gets nothing.
Okay, and are there caps on fees out of those amounts as well?
There's not caps on fees. There is not, correct. That's a contractual issue with a personal representative.
Thank you. I think that's all. Yes.
As an attorney, are there ethical guidelines on fees in the state of Oregon?
There certainly are, yes.
Tell us about those.
Well, you cannot charge an excessive fee or you're going to get in trouble with the bar. And so a lot of times in wrongful death cases, the attorneys work on a contingent fee, and they're taking the risk, and they're funding the cases most of the time with all the costs, and they're entitled to get reimbursed for the costs and a reasonable fee, whatever's agreed upon. But there is ethical rules against charging excessive fees.
Representative McLean.
I guess the only question I have is you mentioned something about the constitutionality and the case that is either in the courts or just out of the courts. Is it just out of the courts?
There were two cases. There was a case in 1995 that held that the cap was constitutional in a death action. Mm-hmm. There was then the case in 1999 that said it was unconstitutional and violated the right to jury trial in personal injury actions.
Okay.
There was then a case in 1995, I believe, 2005 or 6,
okay,
that held that the cap was still constitutional in a death action, and that's the case that has been questioned.
Okay.
It has been questioned by sitting judges now and sort of inviting the issue to come back, and I'm more than happy to accommodate them as soon as I can find the right case.
Okay, got it. Thank you.
I just have...
Yes, Representative. Representative Buehler.
Chair, if I can, can you give me an idea what reasonable fees typically run in these cases?
What reasonable fees are?
Yeah, what the standard fees are, something that wouldn't trigger a bar concern.
Typically, in a wrongful death case, let's say the case was an auto accident case and somebody rear-ended somebody else, clear liability, and the insurance carrier is going to give the money over right away, then in those cases, the fee is going to be, I believe, what I think is ethical, but you'd have to ask others, is quite low or an hourly rate. But if you handle a case that is litigated, then the typical fee arrangement is one-third of the amount recovered, plus the costs that are incurred. But if the attorney isn't successful, then the attorney gets nothing.
That was a big question.
Did you want to answer your question?
Mm-hmm. Follow-up? What percentage would trigger an unethical allegation in that situation?
Well, I'm not an ethics lawyer, and so I don't know.
It's your industry.
What's that?
It's your industry.
I don't know what would cause a bar complaint with respect to a contingent fee arrangement.
So,
I don't know.
Potentially,
All I can tell you is what I do personally.
So potentially a large proportion of this increase in the cap could go to legal counsel.
Well, part of it would be, yes, because it's on a contingent fee. Yeah. But I got to explain to you that without the contingent fee system, most of these people who have very little economic loss would be cut off, and corporations would get away with all kinds of problems of killing people, hurting them because they couldn't get it, they could never afford an attorney if they did it by the hour. So
that's quite a claim. Can you substantiate there's people dying that are not getting legal representation?
Sure. If there's a wrongful death claim and somebody is like Mr. Lane, his family, they don't make hardly any money. And if they come to a lawyer and say, well, I'm going to charge you by the hour for your time to pursue a wrongful death claim.
I'm not talking about
Let him finish his response first.
Okay. There's no way they could pay for an attorney because they don't have the funds to pay hourly for an attorney like insurance carriers do.
Yeah,
that's why the system's been set up that way.
Follow up? Yeah, I'm not disputing the hourly versus contingency. I'm disputing that people are not able to find legal representation for wrongful death suits at the current cap level. So did Mr. Lane not...
That's not what he's saying.
No, I'm not saying that at all.
That's what you just said. You just said that these people are having a difficulty finding legal representation for these suits because
You said in the absence of a contingency fee, they would have difficulty.
Right.
Totally understand that.
Okay.
Maybe I'm not clear. So currently, with the contingency situation, are people who have wrongful death suits not able to find legal representation?
They are. Yeah.
So the cap right now is not preventing people from getting legal representation.
I completely agree with that.
Thank you. That was my point.
Okay.
Other Representative Hoyle, didn't you have another question? Representative Stark, while she's thinking, you can go.
Thank you.
Did you have another comment?
Yeah. Okay. I know you said you're a trial lawyer. Did you say you're representing the Trial Lawyers Association? Today.
I'm a member of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association.
I'm legitimately trying to understand, the sides here. Do you know, would the Trial Lawyers Association be open to something where there would be a cap put in place on their fees so that anything above what is currently in place wouldn't necessarily make it so they were making more money, but the victim would actually get more of those proceeds?
This is to the whole purpose of this informational meeting is to raise the limit on non-economic damages, not about attorney fees and contingency fees. So I can't represent that what the Oregon Trial Lawyers' position is on that because that's not the topic of the day, is my understanding. So I'm not prepared to testify to that.
All right.
Representative Boyle?
So a couple of questions. So you said, in a case that isn't settled right away, that attorney fees could be somewhere around a third. So let me ask you, how long does it take for one of those cases to, how long do you have to work on that case before you get paid? And before you get paid or not get paid, because if there's no settlement, if you don't win the case, you don't get paid at all, regardless of how many hundreds of hours you put in, correct?
Correct.
So how long does a complicated, like a case that where someone, the attorney fees would be a third of whatever is paid out, how long would you work on that before you got paid?
Well, I can answer that question, or Catherine can, but I handle... First of all, you have to investigate a case and determine whether the case is valid and has merit. And once you do that process, then you file a lawsuit. Then typically in the cases that I handle, the trial date is usually approximately 2 years out from the date ultimately that the case is filed. So during that period of time, then depositions of all the people involved have to occur. That's the typical period of time, about 2 years is in my experience. That you're working on the case, and sometimes you lose and get nothing, and sometimes you're able to settle, and sometimes you go to a trial and let a jury decide.
And after the jury verdict, if there's an appeal, it will take easily 2 to 3 to 4 years longer before there's a resolution. So that in the Greist case, the case of the runaway truck in Siskiyou Pass, I believe it was 10 years after the incident before there was any payment on the judgment.
And then follow up. So you said you do depositions and investigations and other things. Who pays for that? Your firm pays for that?
Yeah.
So you pay for that out of pocket, and you may or may not get that paid back. But your firm loans the money to
Yes.
The person you're representing.
Yep. And if we lose, we don't get it.
Right.
Okay. Did you have a thought? Excuse me. Rayfield, sorry.
Two quick questions. One, and we were talking about the money that you might loan to a case in a given situation. What's the range of money that you might loan to a case?
In the cases that I have, typically if we go to trial, I'm loaning between $150,000 and $200,000. And if I lose, I don't get that back.
And so the other questions that I had for you was just about safety in the community and what you've seen with your cases with safety in the community.
I think it definitely improves safety in the community. And in fact, in some of the cases I've had, I've been able to get them to put on education programs to inform the company, whichever one it is, of what occurred in the particular case and to ways to prevent that from occurring so it doesn't occur to other people. People who end up with wrongful death claims, one of the main concerns that they always have is they don't want this happening to somebody else. They want the person who died to not die in vain and make sure that somebody else doesn't happen to them. And they're concerned about that just as much as any money in these cases, in my experience.
Did you have a question? Representative Bueller.
Thanks, Chair Fagan. Do trial lawyers in general ever take money from, for lack of a better word, investors that invest in these cases and then expect to pay back if they have a favorable decision?
Investors?
Yeah. So people who loan you money or give you money anticipating an outcome favorably that then get paid back?
There are companies out there.
There are.
That will loan money to litigants in a lawsuit. They're out there. I always strongly recommend my clients to never do that. And I've never done that personally.
And I think I'll, Representative Holby.
So just going kind of back to basics, are there, I don't know, you may or may not be the right people to ask the question or have the information. Is there information available or that we could get that would tell us like how many wrongful death cases there or claims there are, whether they're filed or not filed and in the last couple of years and you know how many of them are settled, you know, for non-economic damages and how many of them go to trial and you know just to have some data about the magnitude of what we're looking at.
I don't know that information is available at all. And one of the issues with respect to that is a lot of times insurance carriers want everything to be confidential so you can't find out what things settle for.
It seems like it'd be valuable information for us to have to figure out what to do.
I would agree.
Yeah, I just wanted to, I guess for this panel, I'll kind of ask the last question, and I appreciate Representative Holby. I kind of wanted to kind of center it back on the topic at hand is that there is a system that we really, in all other cases, like you mentioned, if somebody is only injured and not killed, then we trust a jury to say how much did that person, how much pain have they suffered? How much did they suffer at the moment that they were dying? How much pain do their kids and their parents continue to suffer throughout the loss of their life? I mean, a 10-month-old baby dying. So in all these other cases, with the exception of the death ones, we trust a jury to say, look, this is what this is worth. This is what, you know, the scales of justice, this much harm has been done. We can't give somebody's life back. We can't give them a new kid that will somehow make the loss of their old one better. All we can do in our system of civil justice is to compensate with money. And in all these other instances, we trust a jury to say, here's what it's worth, except in this one narrow instance, we don't. We say, regardless of what the jury believes, after hearing all the evidence, we're going to cut that off. And so that's, I appreciate the stories that you told about, you know, real life people who've had to experience these losses and juries looked at it and believed that the scales of justice were righted if this amount was paid. And then automatically by statute, people who are sitting here who've never heard all the evidence immediately re-tip the scale and say, nope, we don't believe that it's worth that much. And I think that is, from my perspective, just from a policy matter, a very telling and interesting thing that in this one instance we decide that we know in all cases you know, what should be on that one side of the scale instead of a jury who's actually listening to the stories of the families and looking in the face of grieving families. So it's not really a question, just kind of a close it out, at least from my view, a comment. And thank you for your testimony and hope you guys will stick around in case we have some follow-up. There might be an opportunity to come back. I don't know how the other, you know, panel, if there'll be things we want to ask you after we hear from them. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next panel, if you're all fine coming up together, is James Dorrigan, John Polino, and Dr. Robert Orfali. How did I do on that?
Pretty close. Orfali.
Okay. What is it?
Orfali.
Orfali, okay.
Thank you.
And just like before, you guys go ahead and testify in whatever order you prefer. Just please introduce yourself for the record, and panel, I think, or colleagues, I think just like last time, we'll let the entire panel make a presentation, and then we'll follow up with questions. So go ahead.
My name is Robert Orfali. I'm an orthopedic surgeon practicing in Portland, and I represent the Oregon Medical Association.
Good afternoon. I'm John Polino. I'm an attorney in private practice at Garrett Heeman Robertson here in Salem. I defend doctors in medical cases and other health care providers in medical cases, and I'm here today to present my opposition.
Good afternoon. I'm Jim Dorrigan, regional operating officer for the Doctors Company. We insure approximately 2,300 physicians in the state of Oregon, and I've been engaged in this issue since the 1983 when I joined the industry. I was actually involved in testifying when the cap was instituted. And at the time the cap was instituted, $500,000 was viewed as a huge amount that wouldn't be reached in any jury verdicts for non-economic damages. Since that time, we've seen some real changes. The economic damages in a case, talking about numbers, I looked at the last 5 years, and we've defended about 100 wrongful death cases in the state of Oregon against physicians and medical practitioners. We see huge economic damages. The economic damages, John Polino will talk about, but they can a plaintiff can collect for future loss of lost wages, past wages, loss of services. Non-economic damages is in addition to that, so I want to be clear that it is the pain and suffering, loss and companionship. So something that's very difficult to quantify. A question came up earlier about what do other states look like in terms of damage caps, and I provided with my testimony the western states, and that was a question that came up. In the western states, only Washington, Wyoming, Utah and Arizona have unlimited damages, unlimited non-economic damages in wrongful death cases. Utah had a cap of $450,000 that was thrown out by their Supreme Court in mid-2015. So in looking around the states, California has a $250,000 cap on all non-economic damages in any type of case, wrongful death and other. And in 2014, that was brought before the voters of the state of California, and they upheld that cap. Idaho has a $326,000 cap, Nevada, $350,000, Montana, $250,000, North Dakota, $500,000, South Dakota, $500,000, Nebraska, $500,000, $250,000 in Kansas, $350,000 in Oklahoma, and $250,000 Texas, $200,000 New Mexico. So in Oregon, having a $500,000 cap that was established in 1986, 1987, does not make Oregon an outlier. If we were to eliminate the cap, it would make Oregon an outlier. Why this is so critical to the medical community is one of the key stable components in the cost of practicing medicine, the healthcare dollars, has been the malpractice insurance for physicians. And in Oregon, and in particular, things have been very stable for a long period of time. The last 5 years rates, in fact, today, doctors are paying less for their malpractice insurance than they did in 2002 in today's in real dollars. So it's been a stable area. The biggest spike that I've ever seen in this industry is in 1999 when the cap on economic damages was thrown out for physicians in the state of, the overall cap of non-economic damages was ruled unconstitutional. We saw an influx of cases that caused a huge problem in the system. We were seeing non-economic damages being pled in cases of $10 million, $20 million, $30 million. We were seeing $30, $40, $50 million lawsuits against physicians with $1 million or $2 million in insurance coverage. It caused a huge problem. Carriers withdrew from the state. It was very difficult for physicians to buy or afford insurance. We've got a stable market right now. I don't want to see that destabilized. Medical malpractice rates for rural physicians were viewed as not affordable, and the legislature responded by putting in a rural health subsidy. So we subsidize rates, the state subsidized rates for rural practitioners. That situation seems to have stabilized, but if we see an escalation again in rates in Oregon, I'm worried that we'll be able to attract and maintain physicians in the state of Oregon. An interesting graph that I provided with my testimony is looking at three states on the West Coast, and I looked at rates for physicians in San Francisco, Portland, Oregon, and Seattle, Washington. So let's take the example of obstetrics. In obstetrics, in San Francisco, California, an obstetrician will pay $25,000. In Portland, Oregon, they'll pay $40,000. In Seattle, Washington, they'll pay $64,000. So if you look at that, California has a $250,000 cap on all non-economic damages. Oregon has a $500,000 cap on non-economic damages only for wrongful death, and there's no cap in Washington. So I would hate to see the rates in Oregon inflate to the level of Washington. Or another issue, my fellow testifiers will talk about, is that two sessions ago we created Senate Bill 483 for early discussion and resolution. And that's a process where physicians can engage their patients in early discussion, resolve cases before it goes through the litigation process. We need to give that a chance to work, and we're just starting to see cases come through that process. And I'd like to close and say that healthcare is under great financial pressure. Professional liability insurance has been a stable part over the last 5 years for physicians and healthcare providers. We need to maintain that stability in Oregon because it's critical to access, physician recruitment, and affordable healthcare. So with that, I'll turn it over to John if you want to go next.
Thank you, Chair Fagan and members of the committee. I'm here today to oppose this. My practice over the last many years now has focused on the representation of physicians and healthcare providers in malpractice cases and licensing matters that often go with those malpractice matters. I'm here to oppose a tripling of the statutory cap on wrongful death non-economic damages, but I think as a threshold matter, it's really important to understand that the non-economic damages portion, the only capped portion, is only one of the categories of damages available, both in general tort cases and in cases of medical negligence. Economic damages are not capped in Oregon. And economic damages in a wrongful death case are enumerated under the statute that allows for wrongful death claims to be made. At common law, wrongful death was not a claim that was available to the family or estate of the decedent who was killed in an accident. In Oregon, we have recognized that now by statute. And for some many years, we've also had a cap on non-economic damages, but not on medical, hospital, and nursing costs, rehabilitation services before death, burial and memorial services, the cost of those. The loss of income of the decedent prior to death can also be requested, and then the future expected accumulation of earnings after death during a normal life expectancy. There's also the potential for an economic claim with proof for the economic loss of services that a parent or a child may provide to a family member. Non-economic damages are just one category. The Uniform Jury Instructions describe non-economic damages, and in fact the statute describes them as subjective non-monetary damages. And I think that's an interesting description or definition for these damages, because it's a little bit circular, obviously. They're non-monetary, non-economic damages. The Uniform Civil Jury Instructions also go on, though, to say that when considering the evidence in a case, we shouldn't use personal feelings or sympathy. This area, non-economic damages, unfortunately, is the area that is most susceptible to using sympathy and emotional responses rather than evidence that is presented of the damages in the case. I will digress just a little bit to comment on a question that was asked with regard to where money goes that is received as part of a wrongful death claim. The only party that's entitled to bring a wrongful death claim is the estate itself and the personal representative of the estate, and there's a process for that that personal representative to be appointed. Once that happens, then that personal representative is authorized to proceed with a case on behalf of the decedent for wrongful death if they wish. There then, at the end of the case, if there's a settlement or a verdict in which payment is made, an opportunity to distribute that money out to various people. But the non-economic damages portion of that settlement or verdict goes in two different ways. It's either the pain and suffering of the decedent prior to death, or it is specifically the loss of companionship, society, to individual family members, and there's really three groups: the children, the spouse, and the parents. And the judge is allowed and authorized to determine who that goes to. So that's how that works, to answer that question. I come at this primarily from the standpoint of defending physicians, and I can tell you that even with the current limit, it's very common for that number that's pled in a complaint for alleged negligence to exceed the amount of that physician's or that group's insurance coverage. That brings in their personal assets. It makes them susceptible in a position where they're trying to help people. It makes them susceptible to claims when there many times is no allegation that the physician is attempting to do something other than provide good care, and may have provided it in a way that was harmful to the patient, unfortunately. But in those situations, the risk is great for personal exposure. And that's bad for physicians, bad for healthcare professionals, but it's also bad for Oregon. We hear, when we defend physicians, we get an opportunity. It's a nice, rewarding, and challenging job to have, but we have an opportunity oftentimes to speak to young physicians and residents who are looking to bring their practice to a particular state. This is an issue that comes up. How much is your cap? Do you have a cap? What's the climate like in your state? Are you a hostile state to physicians? When considering this, the committee should consider whether tripling this cap is going to send a message to the best and the brightest physicians that we would like to have come here and practice here, help our people, help our citizens, and whether that's going to send the message that you want to send.
Chair Fagan, committee members, thank you for allowing me to address the committee. As a physician, I think that it's easy to say that we understand firsthand what the loss of loved ones means to families of our patients. And we believe that remedies should be available for both economic and non-economic damages. I won't reiterate points brought up by the other testifiers, but I think just to emphasize the aspect of what the predictable consequences are of a tripling of the non-economic damages, particularly with regards to access to health care. In particular, access to health care at at-risk populations and in rural Oregon. As has been testified, there is strong evidence that there is a correlation between the increase of a non-economic damage cap and the amount of malpractice insurance premiums. And that does not need to wait for a court claim to actually be settled, since insurance is somewhat predictive. As soon as the cap is increased, physicians can expect to see an increase in their malpractice premiums. And clearly there are issues as small business owners, particularly for rural physicians, to make ends meet. That is the reason why there is a rural medical liability reimbursement program that the OMA advocates for strongly every time it comes up for renewal, because it has been found to be an important element that keeps docs in rural communities taking care of patients in need. And as a physician in Portland, I see that even that has limitations, because I routinely see people drive hundreds of miles to come to see me for complex cases, yes, but even for very routine care that really ought to be available in their own community. And so that imposes difficulties for those families, economic difficulties, because often the patient needs to be accompanied by family or friends, and sometimes they simply forego that care because of the trouble of traveling for long distances because the care is not available in their community. So if premiums increase in an unpredictable manner, I think we can expect to see that some providers, especially in high-risk specialties such as obstetrics, may close their practice or limit their practice for high-risk patients. And this will add cost to the system, will add cost to the government if we are going to adjust the rural medical liability reimbursement program to compensate for the increased premiums paid by rural doctors. As well, as was mentioned, in 2012, at the direction of the governor and legislative leaders, the OMA worked in good faith with the trial lawyers to develop an early discussion and resolution program, and that was passed in 2013. Now, that doesn't really give us enough time to properly evaluate the program. Only a few cases are starting to make their way through the program, but I think that it would be a very unfortunate event if we basically then made physicians less likely to avail themselves of that program because of fear of increasing their exposure through the court system. And so for these reasons, I really want to emphasize the unintended consequences, perhaps, but the expected or predictable consequences of a tripling of the non-economic damages cap.
I have a quick clarifying question, and then Representative Hoyle, do you know if for all these other states that you're pointing out here, are these the statutory amount, and do any of these states have their statutory amount adjusted for inflation or COLAs, or does every state like Oregon had a dollar amount put in statute that's never been adjusted for inflation? Do you know if any of these states, if these are amounts post-adjusted for inflation, or if they do?
State to state. California is not an adjusted cap. Idaho is an adjusted cap. It adjusted. It started at 250. It has increased to 326. It had adjusted before the legislature addressed that in 2004, and then they brought it back down to 250 and started over. There's another state that has an automatic adjustment where it's capped. It's currently working through the caps and capping it at 400. The other interesting part is all of these states have some kind of a combination of a cap or an excess fund provided by the state. So each state recognizes that this is an issue, and each state has had a different solution. Through the years with the legislature, we've had committees and task forces that I've served on, and we've looked at all of these various options, and we've the last task force came out with Senate Bill 483. Prior to that, no type of solution or answer was provided. So we do have one thing that we're working jointly on, but we've looked at state funds and various options, and the state has never elected to go through with those.
Representative Hoyle?
Just a couple of comments, and thank you for your testimony and for being here. First of all, Mr. Dargan, in your testimony, and I looked through it, you talk about the what would happen if we eliminate caps. And so to be clear, this proposal doesn't eliminate the wrongful death cap. What it does is it increases it. So I think that's an important clarification.
But it's not very important in my consideration in that the majority of the doctors that I insure purchase a limit of $1 million. So the $500,000, there's a chance that we could defend a non-meritorious case with them. The other thing that my actuaries are telling me is that as the cap goes above $500,000, it's very difficult to define an economic value into your rating structure. So at $1.5 million, they're saying it's essentially the cap amount is over any limits or over the limits that are purchased by physicians. So there's no economic value to the physicians of a cap at $1.5 million.
So thank you for that explanation. But because your testimony was is in the record, I wanted to make sure that the record was set straight, that what we're talking about is a $1.5 million cap. We're not talking about eliminating cap, although I appreciate your explanation as to why you think that those two are similar, but they are not.
My testimony when I was invited to testify, the bill or an LC was not identified.
That is totally fair. I appreciate that.
My testimony addresses both elimination or the increase
right.
of account.
So, and this would be an increase. So just want to clarify
okay.
that.
Follow up.
Thank you. Secondly, in California, we've talked about their cap at being $250,000, I think. And is that not just for medical wrongful death, for medical wrongful death, not for abuse and product liability deaths?
It is for medical negligence.
Medical negligence.
And it is both non-economic, or it is non-economic damages for any case.
So for any case, even abuse and product liability?
Or any medical negligence case.
Okay, so it doesn't cover, like what we're looking at here is
correct.
Not
it's
just
not
medical
broader.
Negligence.
It's not across
we're
all.
We're also looking at the fact that when there is abuse and product liability, that this would lift the caps on those as well. So in California, if someone has a family member that died because of some product liability, some defective product, they actually could get more than would that be unlimited? Would that be an unlimited amount?
In
there
California,
any cap?
I'm not an attorney and I'm not licensed in California. I know the medical negligence
okay.
rules,
right,
but I believe that there would not be a cap on a products liability case in California.
Okay, and then just two quick follow-ups. One is, Dr. Offaly, thank you for being here, and I also appreciate, you know, representing a rural area. It's important that we do whatever we can to help ensure that rural practitioners practice in rural areas, and which is why we support whatever we can to help compensate those doctors for being out in the rural areas and for those costs. However, you talked about the discussions on the early resolution process for medical malpractice that the trial lawyers and the OMA got together to work out, but that only covers cases where there are injuries, so there are no caps at all. Is that not correct? I mean, that's a process designed for smaller scale events as opposed to wrongful death cases. Is that not correct?
I do not believe there's any limit that prevents it from being used for wrongful death in medical cases.
Okay, but was it not, I mean, my understanding, because I did some research before I came here. I'm not a trial lawyer and I'm not a doctor, so I just did a bit of research. But my understanding is that early discussion and resolution process was specifically focused on smaller scale events and not medical malpractice deaths.
It's specifically not. It's listed for serious injury cases as defined under the statute. So, and it does not exclude wrongful death from what I recall.
Okay.
Representative Hoyle? Excuse me, Hovey. You guys should not sit next to each other. That's going to be very hard.
Wasn't my choice.
Hovey.
Ouch.
I'm used to it. We're next to each other in Lincoln.
Thank you. Sorry for the... I have basically the same question for you. I'm sitting here listening to this, and I'm sort of a numbers guy. I'd really like to figure out, you know, the numbers are what we're talking about. You know, how many wrongful death claims are filed or unfiled? I mean, what kind of numbers are we looking at? And, you know, how many of them are, you know, go to trial? How many are settled? And what are the results, you know, of that in terms of that? And it seems like that data has got to be out there somewhere. But otherwise, your insurance companies couldn't figure out what to charge you on your premiums. So where can this committee access that data? I'm surprised that the trial lawyers' representatives say they don't have access to it. So does anybody have access to that information, or is it?
Let me start with some places where you might find it, because I don't think there's going to be any one. There will be any one place where you will find all of that information. You'll certainly find it within the filings, the court filings. And we have a great new electronic filing system in the state of Oregon and record keeping, where we have a lot more of that information than we used to have readily available. That's one place, but not all cases are filed. That's part of the discussion here. Some cases are resolved early, but there are different carriers. There are different insurance carriers for parties. So you'd have to go to the individual carrier to get some of that information. And there are all kinds of different kind of carriers. There's malpractice carriers. There's trucking and auto carriers. So it's going to take some effort to get all that. But I thought that the response from my colleague, Ms. Clark, was instructive. These are very infrequent situations in which the statutory limit on non-economic, one of the types of damages available in a wrongful death case, might exceed the cap that's been in place and is a reasonable sum still, $500,000.
For my narrow portion of the industry, the data is available with the Oregon Medical Board. All cases are required to be reported to them against physicians that result in a payment, so we could pick up the payment portion, but not the portion that are dismissed or successfully defended. And then the National Practitioner Data Bank is also a depository for information on paid claims, but not the ones that are dismissed or not paid. So absent that, you'd have to go to each individual carrier, and I do have the data for our company because we use it for pricing and rating purposes. And one of the things that we're looking at right now is in Florida, we're the largest insurer. The wrongful death cap was knocked out there, and we've seen a 23% spike in the wrongful death cases as compared to the other cases that we have. And relative to our this number of doctors we insure, we're estimating additional costs of $15 to $20 million a year. So, yes, it is material, and we do have an example.
Follow up. So if I'm understanding you correctly, the total claims, you know, is a number that may not be available.
Wrongful death cases.
Right.
Against the universe of causes of action.
So would those things be going through the insurance companies, all of those claims?
On the medical negligence cases?
On the wrongful death.
Wrongful death?
Just overall.
For the most part, they would, but you've got, you know, maybe 50 insurance companies writing various forms of coverage in the state, and medical negligence is one portion of it, where we've got really three or four companies writing the majority of the physicians.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a corner of it, and it, you know, auto accidents.
But when they establish their premiums, they, you know, have all their actuaries. But they do, I think, go through the insurance division. So maybe we could get the data there, perhaps.
There would not be specific data on a cause of action, but there would be data on how the rates are developed. And basically, they're there an estimate of frequency, how many cases there are going to be, and what the severity, the average cost of cases. But it won't go into specific cause of actions in any actuarial report or analysis.
Follow-ups?
I know. It's just trying to figure out how to get the information we need to make a good decision here, and it doesn't sound like it's very readily available. So I guess I'll, Madam Chair, pursue questions to the insurance division to see if they can help figure that out for me. I don't know.
Representative Stark?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My questions are now turning more into just a general request for information for all those out there and interested, because I know there's a bunch.
Home.
Yeah,
so I want to go a little bit more specific on some of the information I would love to look at. Okay, you know, in Oregon, how often does a jury award over the 500,000? And what are they? And when they do, what's the average? I'd love to know that number to see, is this actually even a real issue that the cap is making a difference? In other states, you know, that aren't capped, how often does it actually go up? Another specific to numbers that you guys gave us, and I mean, you may know this right now. We haven't asked for this number yet, because your chart. I mean, I love charts, by the way. Great chart. But you're talking about how it would hurt recruitment efforts for physicians. One thing that I think is lacking on this chart that I'd like to see is the number of physicians per capita in each of these areas to demonstrate it actually is hurting recruitment efforts. And because maybe it's not. I don't know, because I don't have that on this. And also some rural comparisons. You know, some areas where, you know, states where in the rural area it's capped versus where it's not, so that you see the difference, and how has it actually hurt recruitment efforts. So those are numbers I would love to have. I get that you may not have them today, but please, if somebody can find a way to generate those and let us know, that'd be great.
Representative Brayfield?
In following up on the numbers thing as well, I think what we need from you, the doctor's company, you have all the claims data. So I think you want to be successful in the committee, you got to give us information. And so I think the information that we're asking for here, what you can do is, you don't have the information for the entire state, but what you can tell us is how many claims you settled for $500,000 in the state of Oregon. You can tell us how many verdicts in the state of Oregon were $500,000. And you can tell us what portion we can look and get how many doctors there are in the state of Oregon, and we can find out how many people you insure in the state of Oregon and figure out what ratio of, you know, you're looking at here, and some at least get a little bit of a feel for some of these numbers. And so that would be very helpful. And that's something we do have, right? Actually, I think I saw you bring a spreadsheet up and place it on the top of your thing that might had numbers. And that'll kind of, so that's something I'm very interested in. I think everybody is, because curious about how those numbers really impact. And then Mr. Polino, I guess the, so you deal with a lot of doctors. So you represent many doctors. And I assume none of them feel good whenever a mistake has ever been made.
Of course not.
Yeah, and I think I want to do, this is a consumer bill, right? This is not about caps. This is not about doctors. This is not about attorneys. This is about human beings, right, that have serious injuries. And that's what this bill is about. And nobody feels good about it. You got doctors that don't feel good, obviously. Do you feel good when you're representing a doctor and you got somebody on the other side that doesn't feel good?
Well, I do feel good about representing doctors. I won't back away from that. Now, the issue is, do you feel bad about a result or an outcome of a case? And I think, just as in a car accident case, a lawyer representing a party whose assets are on the line in a case has to feel like they're doing a service for their client, mm-hmm. and the outcome notwithstanding, there are often and routinely issues about liability in these cases. The question in a medical case is standard of care. We make sure that we have experts to testify.
And that's not what I'm asking, though. So
let him finish his response.
And so yes, I feel good about representing the clients I represent, even when there is an outcome that is a bad outcome. but you still feel bad for the individual, obviously.
And that's what I was getting at. It's not a fun situation to be in. And if you, as an attorney, have seen situations where people have been severely disabled, have you not?
I have on both sides, on the plaintiff's side in non-medical cases and representing physicians in medical cases.
And would you agree that there are some cases where people are severely injured where those damages are greater, the harm that is caused to those individuals? For instance, you know, the loss of a son, the loss of a daughter, the loss of, you know, a dad, a mother, anything like that where you do believe in you? Can we all agree that that is greater than $500,000, the value of that life?
Well, and that's why I went into the other damages that are available. $500,000 is the limit in just wrongful death claims on non-economic damages. We're not talking about economic damages. We're not talking about punitive damages that may be available, as somebody asked about abuse cases, for intentional torts.
And that
in
wasn't
those
my
situations,
question.
There is another form of damages available. I'm sorry to cut you off.
I cut you off. And so that really wasn't my question. So let me make it, hone it in a little bit. You've got a wife, okay? You got a son, right? And so what if I just gave you what they were going to make for the rest of their life minus what they were going to spend? Is that really the value of their life, right? We do actually recognize non-economic damages in the
Absolutely.
State of Oregon. And would you not agree that the value of human life, the non-economic damage component, is greater than $500,000?
Well, I think it really does depend on a situation. I can't answer that incomplete hypothetical. But what I can say is this. This policy that is available for your consideration doesn't just include this non-economic damages issue as a cap. It includes what is the effect of raising this cap on other things, such as, are these cases going to be able to be settled for a reasonable sum of money in a expeditious manner? With a $500,000 cap in a clear liability situation, these cases often settle and settle rather quickly. In a non-clear liability situation, that may not be the case, but at least we have a guidepost to try to get to a resolution. I've represented plaintiffs in non-medical injury cases.
Let's get back to the question.
Let him finish. You're not cross-examining. Let him finish. This is a public testimony.
And in that situation, you hope that families reasonably consider getting rid of the case and resolving it with a reasonable sum of money in return, without the trouble and the heartache of going through a trial. So there is some value in that early settlement and in the probability and predictability of having a cap.
The problem is you're asking us to put a dollar figure on life, and that's a hard equation, and it's one that we're concerned about when we put it in front of a jury. And also raising the cap, as John mentioned, is going to make it more difficult to settle these cases. The 9/11 Commission was asked to do the same thing, and they put a price on the non-economic damage value for the wrongful deaths there, and they came up with $250,000 plus $100,000 for each for any surviving spouse or dependent. So.
Well, so Mr. Polino, I'm back. I do need a couple follow-ups.
Okay.
Mr. Polino, I believe you actually can't answer that question, and you're refusing to answer it. So, for instance, if I gave you your wife's income for a given day, and I said, "Here's $500,000," what are you going to do? You'd easily be able to answer that question. So, I do think you can answer it. You're choosing not to. To kind of move from there, just to move off of that, because the law in Oregon is really: you make a mistake, you're negligent; you make it right. Right? And that is the concept of the tort law. With the current cap of $500,000, although you don't believe that certain lives are not worth $500,000 in non-economic damages, if we did take that premise that lives were worth greater than $500,000, we can't make it right. We can't fix the harm, or we can't help the harm or compensate for that harm with that cap. I mean, would you agree with me on that?
Well, I take exception to your comment, but with regard to the that specific question, I don't think that I agree with your statement.
That's fair. So I'll back off, and I do apologize. I just kind of am a little bit shocked. So the other thing that, from a legal perspective, when we create a situation where the damages or the harms in Oregon are primarily based in a wrongful death based off of economic damages, the lost wages and things like that, would you agree with me that the value of someone who's a fry cook at McDonald's is not worth as much as, say, someone like yourself or, you know, myself, who are attorneys in the state of Oregon?
Well, I understand the argument. The point, though, is that there are proof elements in any kind of a civil case. One of the things that you have to prove are economic damages. If a particular person isn't going to accumulate a lot of money, then they haven't proven that they're going to lose, that the estate is going to lose a substantial sum of money. So you're right. This is a category of damages that's limited. It's limited to what I think we can all agree is still a substantial amount of money, $500,000. And I think, to your point, I don't think you can put $1.5 million on somebody's life and think, well, that's just the right amount of money.
Right.
You can't do that. It's a very difficult thing for people to do, and we ask juries to do that in other areas. This is a particularly difficult one, but still, with the policy in place, a substantial amount of money that is being provided.
And so I apologize. I actually heard what you just said there, and so I feel more comfortable with it. And then I just had one question, if you don't mind.
Last one.
And it's just specifically about some of the doctor company in general. And I was kind of looking at some of the financial stuff that you guys have there, and I wanted to better understand it a little bit. So as I was going through, you have brochures, you know, on, like, all over the place. And so the one that I was looking about, I was trying to understand how things are functioning. And so, looking at it, you have, it appears to be, about 77,000 members? Is that
correct?
Okay. And is that spread throughout the entire United States?
Throughout the country.
Okay. And then, essentially, they pay premiums into the system.
Correct.
Correct. And then you have investments, which then... From the premiums that have been brought into your company,
right? We put our premiums into reserves to pay for claims, and we also have a surplus, or the owner's equity in the company.
Okay,
and we are an insurance exchange, so we are owned by those 77,000 members.
Okay,
we're like a mutual company.
And so I was, you know, that. So it says $1.8 billion in member surplus.
Is correct.
That's the. The investors.
That's or the owner's equity.
Okay.
Or what the members.
And then there's it's like $3.5 billion that's in bonds and equity securities. Is that also owned by the members?
Yeah, you have to understand the balance sheet of an insurance company.
Total. So I have no idea.
You have your total assets minus liabilities equals owner's equity or surplus.
Okay.
So the total assets are our biggest asset. Is a liability set aside to pay claims around the country. So you subtract that and any other obligations, and that's the surplus of the company. So that's the $1.8 billion.
Does the return on the $3.5 billion that's in assets have any impact, like you get from your investments, whether it's 5%, 4%, or 3%? Does that have any impact on the premiums that you guys set?
Absolutely. It allows – it's part of how we calculate our rates. So the investment income goes to benefit our members, and we have investment income, so we can charge a lower rate.
Okay, that helps.
Representative McLean.
Well, first of all, I have a question, and I don't know if it's for you or for the lawyers or both, but I wanted to make a statement first, just really short, and that is, I look at professionals like doctors and trial lawyers, not as bad actors, but as professionals that we need in our community to help us with services that we need. And so I'm here today not to look at the virtue, because I think we do have guidelines and we do have requirements on behavior of those two groups as well. But what I really want to look at today is how do we make something that I value, which is the American justice system, how do we make that work the best way possible? So that's the filter that I'm using when I'm listening to everybody. And so I really value the judge and the jury in these situations. And I did hear from the panel that was the lawyer's panel that the juries that are dealing with this don't often know about the cap until they've already deliberated. And so they've deliberated not knowing about the cap. So the cap means nothing to them. So I don't see them being slowed down, because I see them as being, they're doing their work. They're getting the information. They're going through the trial, and they're doing their work. So I guess I wanted to ask you, how many times do you think you appear in front of a jury or versus just a judge? Because you guys also mentioned some things that was a judge's choice.
Yeah, so virtually all medical negligence cases are pled as a jury case.
Okay.
These cases rarely go to trial, and I would say that probably more medical negligence cases go to trial by percentage than auto cases, mm-hmm. for instance, but almost all to a jury.
Okay, thank you.
And the other thing that's interesting to note is over 80% of our files last year, 84% of our claims were closed without an indemnity payment. So those are cases, many medical negligence cases are driven by a bad outcome, not bad medical care.
And if I may just add one thing, that just as Representative Rayfield was very eloquent in kind of bringing it down to the person in the claimant. Remember, too, that medical practitioners are the individual, and we don't see things through the lens of an insurance company. Mm-hmm. And I think when you look at doctors locating or relocating, one suit, even if unsuccessful, that could potentially go over their insurance limit and could bankrupt them, is enough to create a situation where that physician decides to relocate.
Representative Stark.
Thank you, Chair. Well, by the way, I want to remind people we keep forgetting to acknowledge our chair. She is here.
And I'm keeping track.
I very much value open dialogue. And Representative Rayfield, I felt like some of your questions a minute ago weren't all that fair on value. So I'm going to ask some similar questions here, and I want to point something out. When I asked the previous panel about rates, they said that's not pertinent to this discussion because we don't actually have a bill here and it's not related. And I appreciate that you guys tried to answer as far as – sorry, I asked them about fees. You tried to answer about rates, and I think those are both – these all link in. But back to the value of a life. I want to give you an opportunity to answer a question, based off of Rayfield's line of questioning on the value of life. But I have to tell you a quick story. I'll make it quick. I oversee a large nonprofit, an NGO in Uganda. And a couple years ago, I had a child die, an orphan that we'd been sponsoring, because he didn't have access to a doctor. He died of malaria because he had no transportation, easy treatment, no transportation to get an hour to where the doctor was. So I want to ask you guys, what is the value to a community and to people of having access in rural areas to doctors? And I suspect you can't answer that, just like you couldn't really answer his question. This is the ongoing question that we keep having. What is the value? I mean, there's at some point we come to a point where we need both, and we need the two to work together, and we have to understand that. So that is also why I want the data that I asked about. Do your rates determine whether or not there are actually physicians available? So statements, I didn't expect you to be able to answer, but let's keep that in mind.
Representative Buehler.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Easier question here. Is there a shortage of primary care physicians in underserved and rural areas of Oregon currently?
And certainly, I don't have that data in front of me, but I think it is safe to say that in primary care, as well as some critical specialties, there is definitely a shortage, and at very minimum, many communities are barely at their required levels for many medical specialties, as well as other providers.
Paul, yeah. Would raising this cap on non-economic damages worsen that problem to access to physicians in these areas, or would it make it better?
Certainly would not be conceivable to me that it would make it any better, and I think that the expectation is that it would make it worse. That's based on the experience of other states that have gone between having unlimited damages and not, as well as the experience with a medical liability reimbursement program, which we have found has helped stabilize some of the exodus of medical practitioners from rural areas.
And final question. And can you put an economic number on the cost of that pain and suffering of not having access to such physicians in those communities?
I don't think you can.
Thank you.
I don't see any other questions. I'm just going to ask a couple. One, and I appreciate that you guys are willing to give us some data on other states and stuff. I'm an attorney also. I don't do any medical, any kind of medical cases, but I am an attorney, and while I appreciate that data, I'm going to be, I think, a little bit skeptical because I think it's a little bit too easy whether you're, you know, I guess as an attorney and somebody who deals with evidence, when you're trying to make a case, clearly nobody in that panel was objective, nobody on this panel is objective, right? I mean, there's definitely advocacy going on, which I appreciate as a legislator. It's hard for me to imagine that the only difference between Washington and Oregon is purely that Washington has no caps and that Oregon doesn't. I mean, does Washington have an early resolution system like we have? Are there different statutory requirements to bring claims? I mean, so it's hard for me to say, oh, yes, Washington, their medical malpractice is higher, ours is lower. That's the only difference. Well, I'd like to, you know, imagine there's more things that are different. Same with California. I would imagine, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, I would imagine that there's difficult times to find physicians in rural California. I imagine it's hard to find physicians to go to rural Montana, where they both have lower caps than Oregon. So I think that it's easy when we're trying to advocate to kind of pick and choose numbers, and that goes for all sides of every, as an attorney, I know that. And so I definitely would appreciate that data. I don't know, for me, it's not going to be I'm sold, I saw this was a higher amount or than that, because I think there's a lot of complicated factors. I imagine you know that better than anybody, that makes up insurance rates and risk and all of that kind of stuff. So that's one kind of point. I do just, I think, add a little bit of fairness. I just want to ask you, Mr. Polina, are there any statutory caps on the amount that your clients can pay you to represent them?
There are not, with the same exception, right, that Mr. Block mentioned, the clearly excessive fee, I will say that obviously with carriers that have a volume of work, it is normal for carriers to pay somewhat less than other individuals who may come in on a routine basis.
Right, but that would still be a contractual a contractual relationship, just like a plaintiff would have with their attorney.
Correct, and still governed by the RPCs of the Oregon State.
That's a slightly tongue-in-cheek question. I thought it had to be fair that somehow it became part of the big discussion with the other panel, and the reality is, all lawyers are covered by the Oregon State Bar ethical rules. I guess that my kind of closing thought is just, and I you guys can answer this if you want, because we are being asked to consider policy. I appreciate the insurance annuity issues. I appreciate the thought of, whether doctors would or wouldn't have to pay more in medical malpractice. Obviously, this is a much, it feels like we're looking at it through one lens. It's not just about medical malpractice. We heard a story earlier about somebody who, was speeding down a hill and a 10-month-old baby died. That has nothing to do with any doctor. So obviously, this is a bigger issue than doctors, but I appreciate that, we obviously let the kind of the opponents coalition make up their group, and they chose to make it up with doctors. But just in terms of, we're being asked to make policy about what's good for Oregonians, and it just strikes me as interesting, I guess. And I would just, if you have a comment on the policy that when it comes to, and just for kind of colleagues who are not attorneys, non-economic damages is an element of damages in all kinds of cases. It's not just if somebody is physically hurt. It's in employment cases. If someone experiences race discrimination at work, there's a non-economic damages component. If somebody's, sexually assaulted, there's non-economic damages. So there's all these cases where there's non-economic damages. And obviously there's, if somebody at the same, medical negligence causes, somebody's paralyzed but not killed, there's non-economic damages. And it just seems strange to me, I guess, from a policy perspective, that in all of these other areas, we ask a jury and we trust a jury to make a determination about whether we agree or disagree. I'm sure that you make passionate arguments about why that should be lower. The other attorneys make passionate arguments. It seems like in the most horrific possible scenario, losing a loved one is the one place where we say no. I mean, I think this at times heated discussion has made it clear that These are hard questions. So we're asking us, without any knowledge of a family, of what they've experienced, about the suffering, maybe a family that had, you know, years of infertility, finally had a baby, and then it was their 10-month-old baby that was lost, and they can never have another child. There's all these different scenarios, and yet we're being asked to say, nope, and under no circumstances ever is somebody's suffering when there's a death worth more than $500,000. And that, to me, feels very strange from a policy perspective, when in all of these other instances, we let the jury look the family in the face, we let them hear the stories, we let other attorneys argue why it should be lower, and then we trust the jury's decision. So do you have, I guess, a policy answer for us? And if you don't, I respect that, because that might not be what you're here for. Why in this one instance, when the worst possible thing happens to somebody, when somebody's family member dies, why that's the only time that we should say, doesn't matter what the evidence shows, there's no possible circumstance where your suffering is worth more than $500,000.
I personally think we should have a cap on all non-economic damages, and this is the last vestige that we have in the state. If we knock it out, we become an outlier relative to the other states. Non-economic damages is one of the toughest things, especially in medical negligence cases, because they're the types of cases that are emotional. They deal with a bad outcome. Regardless of the medical care, you can put on a very simple and sympathetic case in front of a jury. And it is a frightening thing to take a case in front of a jury with a very sad death, regardless of how good the medical treatment is, or a child that's going to require lifetime care, regardless of how good the medical care was, because the damages can be so big. So as a policy issue, I supported a cap on all types of non-economic damages because they can't be quantified.
That's a fair answer. Thank you. Either of you care to comment? You don't have to. Representative Buehler.
I'll comment quickly, Chair Fagan. I think the beauty of cap on all these things is all of us as part of the society share that risk, because any of these things you outline can happen to any of us sitting here. We don't know who it's going to happen to, and we all share that risk by having a cap equally. And I think it's a good way to mitigate that risk across everyone in society. There's no big lottery winners, and we all get a reasonable amount when there's an adverse event that happens to us.
I would not, it's definitely not considered a winning of a lottery if somebody that I, my family member died, but I understand the point that you're making. I guess as a closing thought, I agree, and it seems like the consensus here is that these are definitely the toughest types of cases to ask a jury to decide. Just being transparent from you, that's exactly the reason to not have a cap, because it feels very odd to me to sit here without any knowledge of what's going on, how much a family's grieving, and to say, there's no possible scenario where that could ever be worth more when we ask a jury to sit there and listen to the families. So that's just kind of my thought. But this has been a very instructive hearing. I appreciate the passion on both sides. Thank you to kind of the coalition that has, you know, brought forward these panelists as well as the other panelists. And I imagine we will see you again when we hear the bill, which will likely be early in the session, since we don't have much time. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
And with that, I'm going to close the informational hearing on the wrongful death liability cap and open an informational hearing on lawn irrigation requirements under the Homeowners Association. Clearly, we are going from controversial topic to very controversial topic.
What I love about this committee, and I'm so thankful that the speaker put me on it, and that is that we hear about skiing, we hear about irrigation and water conservation, and we hear about courts and people's lives. So it's always interesting. And we are switching gears, but I do believe that conservation and resources are important. And I also believe that people have rights, and they get to make choices, and they have values.
Well, let me pause for a moment. Are you into, because I'm happy to call up the panel with you. Do you want to go there, or do you want to stay in your chair?
I would prefer to be the introducer.
Okay, so you just want to kind of introduce.
Today, yeah.
So why don't you give your thoughts, and then we'll just have, I guess for the interest of time, let's go ahead and have Tom Wolf, Jonathan Manton, and we'll have those come up in a panel, and then Tracy and Mark, you guys can come up as your own panel. And so go ahead, Representative McLean.
Thank you very much. And I really appreciate folks who have stayed this afternoon on a Friday afternoon to come in and testify on this bill concept. First of all, I want you to know that this was brought to me by citizens, folks who live in a homeowner's situation neighborhood, where they were being requested to water their lawn to a certain level of greenness. And one of the elements that a couple of the individuals that came to talk to me indicated was that they felt that they had a right to decide how much they irrigated and also how high the bills were for their household. And in some areas, there, because of drought conditions that have been involved in the state, there's been a situation where there have been some increases in water prices and water bills and utilities because of the conservation issues that we are facing when we have to make choices about watering lawns or having drinking water. And I will bring to your attention that on OLIS that we did have turned into us from the Clackamas River Water Providers a letter which indicates that they are really feeling it's important to conserve water because they want to make sure that there's plenty of drinking water. And I know that coming off of December in this valley and in the metropolitan Portland area, we really don't feel as if water is an issue because we had one of the highest December levels of rain that we've ever had in the state. But there are indications that in our future we do have 26 counties that were drought counties this last year, and the governor had to declare them drought counties. And so this bill simply says that homeowner associations cannot request that their homeowners water or irrigate their lawns, the land that they own, in any certain level of greenness. And I'm going to leave it up to the panel to talk about some of the issues and be happy to help with answering questions at the end of their presentation.
Thank you, Representative McClain.
Okay.
Oh.
Please introduce yourself.
All right. Vice Chair Buehler, committee members, for the record, my name is Tom Wolf, the Executive Director of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited, and I'm here to testify in support of this proposed bill. In this summer of 2015, Trout Unlimited is the first of a series of reports where we do introduce what's called the State of the Trout. It looks a lot at the trout populations all across the United States. And historic and as they are now, they identified 28 populations of species of and subspecies of trout across the state, three of which are extinct, but the others are surviving at various levels. In Oregon, there were nine. One is extinct. There are currently eight fairly healthy populations of trout left, three subspecies of cutthroat, four subspecies of rainbows, and bull trout, plus Chinook, coho, chum, and sockeye salmon. These are all found in here. And in this report, they looked at evolving causes of the demise of these trout. And one of the things that came up that's new is water use. And currently, in the United States, overuse of water is one of the biggest problems we're facing for trout and salmon, because stream flows, both for habitat they create within the stream, for temperatures, and for different things, are very important. 14% of all surface withdrawals in the United States are for public communities. That doesn't seem like a large part, but it becomes much higher as you go west of Mississippi. It becomes even higher if you look at high desert areas. Fastest growing area growing in this state is the Bend area, which is a high desert area where they withdraw water from the Deschutes River and its tributaries. So therefore, it has an enormous impact on the trout population. And if you've read in the last couple of years, there have been large die-offs of trout in the Deschutes River, and we're not just talking 10 or 20, we're talking thousands. And this is so water use is a terrible thing. And let's face it, I grew up in an era, and I don't want to date myself, but I'm old, and in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, when I was a kid, having a green lawn was the most important thing you could do in your neighborhood. You know, I lived in the era of the green lawn. And frankly, I think the green lawn area is dead. Who needs a green lawn? I've owned my house in Hillsborough now for 30 years. I've never had a green lawn, so I don't think that's interesting. And lastly, I want to move into economics. Do you realize that fishing brings into the state of Oregon $1 billion a year? People coming into these rural communities to stay in hotels, eat at restaurants, buy equipment, and it becomes very important in rural communities. If you go out to certain parts of the country of our state, in the eastern Oregon, southern Oregon, on the coast, large groups of people come there, especially at certain times of the year, just to fish or to hunt or to watch wildlife. And it brings in wildlife viewing, hunting, and fishing together bring in $2.5 billion. And if there's not enough water in streams, fish die. Fishermen don't come. Money isn't spent in the community. So I think this bill is a good idea. I think that we need to look at every way that we can possibly stop the overuse of water, because I realize, of course, in our continued need for water, we need water for crops, we need water for energy, but we need water for fish. We don't need water for green lawn. So I support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Vice Chair Buehler. My name is Jonathan Manton, and I'm here today on behalf of Water Watch of Oregon. Water Watch, for the last 30 years, has been a conservation organization dedicated to protecting and restoring stream flows for the benefit of fish, wildlife, and the people that depend on them. I want to thank very sincerely Representative McLean for bringing this bill forward and for your previous comments. Much of what I wanted to say is exactly the same thing that you just said, but so sometimes maybe a little repetition doesn't hurt, and I'll try to be very, very brief. As you mentioned, 6 months ago, nearly 70% of Oregon was declared for severe drought conditions. This had consequences. We had junior irrigators that were cut off. Cities were encouraging residents to curtail their water use all across Oregon. Governor Brown issued an executive order directing agencies to plan for drought, and this is kind of amidst some of the climate projections that have been made recently, which expect this to be the new normal, according to her executive order. So with this backdrop, the potential for divisive conflict over water in the state is obviously very large. And so we need to be seeking common sense solutions and doing conservation where we can. We need to be looking for new ways to conserve water. The Corvallis Gazette Times had an article just recently in which it cited a Corvallis landscape architect stating that 7 billion gallons of water on average are dumped each day on U.S. lawns, and approximately 50% of that is wasted. I'm not sure what that architect defines as wasted, but nevertheless, that's an awful lot of water. We believe that private property owners who wish to participate in a conservation by not watering their lawn should be allowed to do so. And so with that, I just want to say thank you very much for bringing this bill forward, and thank you to the committee for having us today.
Thank you very much for your comments. Any questions? Yes. Is it a start?
Thank you, Chair. So, several questions. Apparently, I have a lot of questions today. I'm not trying to pick on your data about the trout, but I trout fish, and they're not in much danger when I go out fishing. But I just pulled up, you know, ODFW website. You know, you hit on trout, and they're advertising Oregon trout available 365 days a year, and they start listing all these rivers that you can go fish for trout in 365 days a year. And it seems like the Department of Fish and Wildlife would be the first ones to raise a flag and rein that in if the trout were in extreme danger to where we affect homeowners association because of the trout. I have a second question. Like that doesn't line up for me. Can you comment?
Well, first of all, having worked with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife and all agencies, they don't put bad news on their websites. For example, I don't know if you realize, but on July 14th of this last year, they closed down fishing on most trout streams across the state after 2 o'clock because of the impact. So I'm not saying that necessarily all trout are going to go away, but it is the overuse of water in urban settings is a cause. I mean, obviously trout fishing is going to be there, but
It is identified in its report. It is identified in the articles of professional societies like the American Fisheries Society that overuse of water does have an impact. You know, DFW is not going to mention that on their website, but they're concerned about it too. If you go down and talk to many of the biologists across the state and the district office, they will tell you that water stream flow is one of the top three causes of demise of trout. The purpose of the website is to encourage people to go out and fish. So there's a different purpose of the website, and it's a difference of what a staff biologist in Bend or Prineville or Burns is going to view as a danger to the fish. So I don't know if that helps.
Fair enough.
Keep it calm, though, Stark.
Dan and I shook hands. Representative Rinker, we're thrilled. Anyway, moving on. Can't even talk. So on some of the statements by Water Watch statements here, on the 7 billion, gallons of water wasted. So one's a question, then if maybe you can explain something to me, because I legitimately don't know. I'm interested. I like numbers. So what is the use for homeowners associations that require, a certain greenness compared to those that don't, compared to subdivisions that don't even have a homeowners association? What is the difference in the amount of water being used? Second is, I've never had anyone explain this to me. I don't live in the city. I have my own well. So if I run too much water on my lawn, it goes into my water table, which comes back out in my well. How does it work in the city if you run too much water? How is that? Would someone explain to me the difference of being on city water and so forth?
And I would encourage you to start with indoor plumbing and then, go from there.
Chair Fagan, committee members, Representative Stark, welcome back. Thank you. It's nice to be in front of your committee. Representative Stark, I don't have the exact data for you, but I'll be happy to try to find out as much as I can and get back to you on it.
Is that on the water cycles?
On both questions. I'm not fair sure. Of the statistics in Oregon with regard to homeowners associations versus non-homeowner associations, and I could give you a very layman's term, explanation of what I know about plumbing, but probably wouldn't be that helpful. So maybe I can just follow up with your office with some more information.
Thank you,
Madam Chair.
I
have just a comment that I'd like to make to the last two questions, because I do have a little bit of that information. First of all, as far as your idea about the water that you're over watering going back to your water table and it goes into your well and then you're going to get to use it again, in a situation in an urban area, that water goes onto usually the cement sidewalk or onto the road and evaporates, or it's not going to good use. It's going to get dirty with whatever else is on the sidewalk or the asphalt, and it's not going to be coming back to the ground and going into the water table as quickly or as in good shape or as much as it would in a rural area. Also, there actually has been a lot of work done on how much water you need to water your lawn, to keep your lawn alive. And to keep your lawn alive, they're saying 1 inch per week. And a lot of times, if you want a beautiful, pristine, green lawn, they are saying that sometimes it's 5 to 6 to 8 or 10 inches a week that people are using on their lawn to get a certain color of greenness. So there actually have been people who actually work on that. And then the final comment, and I know this is a much lighter topic than the one that we just dealt with, but there were a few of my constituents that thought this was kind of important. And so I would like to point out that the whole reason for this is to remember that we have a certain finite amount of water, and that what we're trying to do is make sure that we're using it in a way that we have resources for big areas like drinking water, irrigation of crops, and also making sure that Representative Stark's grandson gets to fish in the rivers in the state of Oregon. So I know this is a lighter topic, but there are a lot of reasons for conservation of water.
Thank you. Any further questions? Representative Holvey.
Just one more, and maybe this is to Representative McLean. So this concept is particularly about private property owners within homeowners associations having the choice of whether or not to keep their lawn green or not.
Yes.
So is that correct?
Yes.
So it really, the comparison of how much happens in a homeowners association versus a city, to Representative Stark's question, you know, those people in the city have the choice of whether to do that right now. I don't know that that it's going to be pertinent to the bill, really. I mean, it's an interesting question, but I just wanted to chime in that this is just about the right to have that control over your property to make that choice to conserve water or not.
Yep.
Thank you very much. And now you guys can be excused. And Tracy and Mark, you guys can come up now.
Yeah.
It's easier.
Good afternoon, Chair Fagan and members of the committee. For the record, Tracy Rutten with the League of Oregon Cities, here today on behalf of the 242 cities we represent. And I thank you for the opportunity to testify and thank Representative McLean for introduction of this legislation and really just the opportunity to talk about what we would consider a very important topic, which is conservation, especially coming out of the year that we've just had in drought. And I know that Vice Chair Rayfield is very excited to have the opportunity to hear the water pitch again, once again, now that he's no longer part of the Natural Resource Subcommittee. So, see if I know how to offer this. I was going to actually bypass the video, and I'm going to now hope it works, but for Representative Stark,
thank you,
who asked a great question about return of the water that municipalities use. Sorry, 3 minutes, but we're going to go ahead now and do that.
Sorry, guys.
Way to go.
Thanks, Stark.
Let's see. He's all wet.
Uh-oh, now we're going to have no
sound.
You probably don't give much thought, but fresh water crosses your mind several times a day. From the moment you first turn on the faucet to that time when the water bill arrives. Considering that a family of four uses an average of this much water a day, it's amazing how little people know about where their water comes from, how it gets to you, or why it costs what it does. So here, with the help of our own water meter, is the least you should know about that water that you not only love, but need to survive. First, everyone's water comes from nature, from snow melting in the mountains, to rivers, lakes, and underground aquifers. Getting this water to where you are can take hundreds of miles of pipe, thousands of watts of electricity, and hundreds of hours of manpower. This is the part of water that you pay for. Your water provider first pumps water from the source through underground pipes to a water treatment facility, which processes millions of gallons of water a day. Here, it's cleaned, filtered, disinfected, and tested constantly by professionals until it's safe for you to drink. This, your future tap water, is then pumped into a pipe distribution system, sending water to homes and businesses through miles of pipe deep underground. Many of those pipes were installed decades ago and must be repaired or replaced. And that's how water arrives where you need it. To shower, wash your dog, cook a meal, water your lawn, put out fires, and make lemonade. Oh, about that water bill? Each month, utility professionals read your meter to track your water use, just doing their job. Water, so vital to life, still costs less than most services we use today. Even after you've used it, your water doesn't disappear. It's collected and cleaned by your local treatment plant until it's safe to return to waterways and be reused by the community or your neighbors downstream. Providing clean water keeps communities healthy. But managing our precious supply while keeping costs down doesn't just happen. Every step in the fresh water cycle is a big job for our nation's utilities. And that's where you can help. By sharing the cost and conserving water for future generations, we can all help to keep fresh water available and affordable today and for years to come. The pleasures and the cost of fresh water belong to all of us. Paying your water bill is an investment in our water future. So here's to safe drinking water, and the pipes, the plants, the power, and the people who make it happen. That is water's true value. To learn more about your own water bill, contact your local water supplier.
Probably not from Flint, Michigan.
Yeah. Oh, too soon. Too soon.
Okay, so your point about the wastewater return there, and that's why we thought we should actually play the video. But in talking about municipal water,
we all know that drinking water is an essential part of life and extremely important for good health.
Just to drill it in your head.
That accent.
After all, we are made up of 65% water.
Water.
Okay.
Okay. Okay.
Absolutely. Yes. Cheerio. So when we talk about our public water system, so obviously then we're talking about municipal water, so that which would be provided by cities such as who I represent or special districts, which are Mark's client. In terms of talking about the overall water use in Oregon, I think it's just important to note generally and have a more broad understanding of what that water means in the context of the greater water picture. Municipal water serves about 3.3 million Oregonians. It is about 88% of the state's population that is served by public drinking water systems. Obviously, that is serving a variety of purposes, public health related, public safety, as well as economic development, attracting a lot of industries and businesses to urban areas. And in terms of when we talk about challenges, which we'll get into, and I will be brief with this today, we are projected to be at 5.4 million by 2040. So it's something that we consider very much when we're planning ahead as cities in terms of how we're going to be able to provide enough drinking water to accommodate that growth. In terms of water use in Oregon, and I thought this might be of interest to the committee today, and this is according to the Integrated Water Resources Strategy, which is a document that was adopted with the Water Resources Department. Approximately 9 million acre feet of water is diverted for out of stream, or what we would call consumptive purposes, which is about 8% of the annual yield. Approximately 91 million acre feet is not diverted, so that is water that is in stream. And about 19 million acre feet of that is protected through what are known as in-stream water rights. So water rights that are held by the state of Oregon for the purpose of protecting that water and dedicating it in-stream. In terms of actual consumptive use breakdown, so that's the out-of-stream use again we're talking about, 85% of that is for agriculture in Oregon. 6% is self-supplied industry, so those industries that don't receive their water through a municipality or a public system. 6% is us, the municipal water, and then another 1% is self-supplied domestic wells for those people who do have a well of their own to draw from. So again, one of the questions that we frequently hear is, if we are viewed as a wet state, why is it that we run into drought problems such as what we experienced in 2015? Some of the main factors, and obviously there's a lot of complicating factors with drought, timing is a big issue in Oregon. The rain that we've seen in the past month, and I've heard it a number of times, and people say, oh, this is great news for the drought. It's not really great news for the drought. It would be great news, and it is great news that we're seeing some snowpack, and we need to see that snowpack continue into really the critical months, which are coming here. So we're hoping for a lot of snow. But that rain that's falling in precipitation, or precipitation falling in the form of rainfall, it is going immediately out. And it's not during our peak demand season. This is not when people are watering their lawns. Mm-hmm. So unless we find a way to store that winter water, which is something that we've been working on, it really is not helping us in terms of drought. Obviously, geography, what you're going to see in the coastal range, what you're going to see in eastern Oregon is extremely different, and it's important to keep those differences in mind when we talk about drought issues. And again, the low to non-existent snowpack in 2015, we had a lot of communities that were really panicked because they were seeing even a non-existent snowpack, and that is their storage. We look at snowpack as a natural storage reservoir, and that's what it is in Oregon, and when we don't see that snowpack, we know that we don't have a supply there. And I do need to update this because it is 26 counties. So I pulled this from a previous document and one more had been added. But obviously, we all know it was a challenging year for Oregon. Those challenges hit all water users. It was in-stream and it's out-of-stream as well that were both very much impacted. For municipalities specifically, this was really the first year we saw some of our cities and districts as well, grappling with the possibility that they would not have adequate supply for their communities to get through the year. And that's not something that we've had a lot of discussions around until very recently. So in terms of municipal conservation, the League recently did a survey of our members. I would actually like to do the survey again now that we've been through this drought season. But this was in June of 2015. We had 65 of our cities respond, noting that 60% of them had conducted recently public outreach on conservation. Of those that did not, 90% were from cities with a population under 10,000. I think kind of demonstrating the need for additional resource for communities who don't have access to that opportunity to educate their public or have a staff person who's dedicated to do that. And I think it's important just to note there's a difference when we talk about conservation versus curtailment. Mm-hmm. And it's a big difference that a lot of people misunderstand. Many of our municipalities have what are known as water management conservation plans. They're often required as a condition of our water permits. And those plans outline various levels, if you will, triggers, and then actions associated with those. For example, and this is probably challenging to read, but you'll see this is sort of a compilation from the survey that we did of the various levels, triggers, and actions. And you'll see that they range from a mild, kind of stage one level, if you will, to moving into actions that are a bit more in the moderate range, and these do differ just based on whatever the municipality has actually decided is appropriate for their community, to getting into some of the more critical alerts where you'll see, for instance, suspension of all water use that's not associated with fire protection or public health. So that's pretty much saying if it's not drinking water and it's not fire, we're cutting that off. So those are things we like to obviously avoid. So in terms of conservation tools, I'm not reading all of these here. I wanted to highlight these came from a few examples from our cities. They did want to be here today, but we couldn't get anyone here on Friday afternoon. Shocking. But they definitely have a number of tools dealing with irrigation specifically. It's an area they focused on, and it's an area that they've been able to see, I think, really great return in terms of actual conservation that they're able to measure. That includes things like surveys. This is a city that's bringing the service in April of 2016, where they will actually do on-site landscape surveys and help identify water efficiency opportunities. So going out into the community, talking with folks. Also, some of the moving down to almost that last bullet point, EPA does have a program, if you will, that helps to essentially certify landscape contractors as those who have done education in water efficiency and conservation. So this is another example from a city talking now about actual conservation incentives of wastewater. So actually trying to make sure that the rate structure incentivizes conservation both on the drinking water side, so what's coming in, and then also again on what's going out of that house to make sure you're not wasting a lot of water. That'd be your dishwashing, laundry, again, irrigation-related issues. And then the metering issue for us has been really important because it allows our municipalities to take a look at possible leaks in the system. And they can be pretty effective in identifying those leaks and getting somebody out to help fix those leaks. And then again, obviously, before I move on, updated residential and commercial irrigation hours, and that is pretty common in our municipalities. This is just one final example of a community. This is City of Hillsborough. They are now paying up to $200 towards the installation of WaterSense labeled controllers for their irrigation systems, and have found that to be a very effective program in that community. And Sustainable Gardening website, they also have some demonstration projects of sustainable gardens as well that they're using. So we've only touched on a number of tools. There's a variety of tools our communities are using. And again, I think there's a lot of technology and a lot of opportunity out there in innovation to make sure that we can assure that we've got a water supply for the communities and to address those concerns long term. Some of the challenges that we face, as noted in the video, even though it was very quiet, we have infrastructure challenges. There are pipes that do have leaks in our state, and it's not something we like to see. It is not economical for us to treat water to a drinking water standard and then have that leak in our pipes. But we have a $5.6 billion need in Oregon in the next 20 years for drinking water alone. It's $3.8 billion for wastewater. So it's considerable, and it's a challenge, and it impacts rates. Conservation impacts to trees. This is the first year we've seen trees that have been dying because people wanted to do the right thing, and they wanted to stop watering their lawn. But they didn't realize that if you stop watering the trees, lawns can come back. Trees sometimes cannot. Mm-hmm. So it's something that we're seeing more and hearing from our customers about. And it's probably another opportunity where we are going to need to educate the public. There are some new water users and industries that we're really curious about, marijuana being one of those, to see what impact that might have for those that are growing within city boundaries or within municipal boundaries. So we're working on the issue and making sure that water is part of the conversation as we move forward with that. Recent opportunities, I'll very quickly note, there has been legislation passed by this body that we very much appreciate to help us address some of the challenges that we're seeing in water supply. Vice Chair Rayfield was very instrumental in helping pass some of the legislation we've looked at in getting additional funding. And that is going to be, I think, very critical in terms of future planning for communities and being able to better, I think, work with other water users to identify opportunities and projects and get some financing and funding for those projects, including storage. I won't get into the implementation of the integrated water resource strategy, as I mentioned that earlier in the presentation, but it really is, I think, a very effective blueprint for Oregon's water resources and provides us with really great recommendations on what we need to do going forward and how we might prioritize those recommendations. And then, let's see, that is it. So right. I'm going to turn it over to Mark.
Good afternoon. My name is Mark Landauer. I'm here on behalf of the Special Districts of Oregon. The Special Districts represents approximately 950 districts across the state, and many of those districts happen to be municipal water suppliers. At the outset, I want to thank Representative McLean for raising this issue. In a moment, I'll tell you why. It's a very timely issue to be discussing. Both Ms. Rutten and I serve on the Governor's Drought Advisory Committee, and it's been a fascinating process watching the drought and the impacts that drought has caused on many communities across the state. I've passed out an article from the Bend Bulletin that appeared, I believe it was in September of last year, that highlights the problem that Representative McLean is attempting to address here. And that is, again, homeowner association covenants that require green lawns. And, of course, the challenge that we have as municipal suppliers is when our water supplies become reduced as a result of drought conditions, having these requirements for watering lawns seems to be counterproductive to trying to maintain your water supply to the sufficient levels to meet consumptive uses, not irrigation uses. And so I think Representative McLean has really keyed in on a very important issue here. I also want to note that there are two letters that you received from some municipal suppliers, one from the city of Gresham and one from the Clackamas River Water Providers. They're a group of cities and districts that supply municipal water to approximately 300,000 people. When our customers want to undertake water conservation measures, we want to encourage it. And there are a variety of reasons for that. And not the least of which is when you conserve water, you reduce the need to expand your infrastructure. During the summer months and late fall, water demands can more than double And that sort of gets to what Ms. Rutten was talking about. We're plenty of water in the winter, but in the summer, demands go double, sometimes triple, and that's when we're getting the least amount of moisture. This measure simply allows an owner of a house or condominium the ability to reduce their outdoor water without the fear of being penalized by the HOA. Interestingly, there is going to be another measure that will be introduced in the Senate, and that measure would have some triggers associated with it that would effectively make the requirement to irrigate water lawns during a declared governor's drought, or if the Water Resources Commission says that there's a drought, or if a local government says that their storage capacity is in jeopardy and they need to reduce it. I'm coming to a conclusion here. Although the current drought has caused a lot of stress in our communities and the environment across the state, it has also significantly increased the awareness of everyone on how precious this limited resource is. We need to capitalize on the awareness that we're generating now as a result of this drought to assist our communities in ensuring that water will be used responsibly, particularly in times of shortage. So again, I'd like to thank Representative McLean for the introduction of this measure. I'd be more than happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Do you have any questions?
It's not a question, but there is one example that you guys have used with me that really made me feel that I wanted to go one more step than what the Senate bill does and not call out the trigger of the drought.
Right.
And that is, I live in Forest Grove, and 45 minutes away in Carlton and the McMinnville area, Carlton ran out of water. Or at least 2 months to the end of their supply?
Chair Fagan and Representative McLean, that city was looking at a significant shortage. They were looking at a 20-day water supply. Luckily, they were able to do an emergency, an agreement with McMinnville to get emergency water to that community to help carry them forward through that shortage.
So I just wanted them to share that because it was something they'd shared with me, and that made me feel that, you know, if you're not in a drought-declared county, there still can be water issues and supply issues, and why not do simple things to conserve water to allow for big, important things like irrigating crops and having water to drink.
Mm-hmm. Any further questions? Okay, thank you guys very much.
Thank you.
And with that, I'm going to close the informational hearing on lawn irrigation requirement.
Oh, a comment. I thought we had one more person.
No, sorry. Go ahead.
I do hope that when we have this conversation later in session, that we do a lot more conversation, as Representative Holvey was saying, about homeowners and their rights as individuals, as opposed to the whole thing being just water and conservation. Mm-hmm. I think those are both important, but I want to hear more on that point as well.
I think Representative Stark is telling you how to get his vote.
Okay.
what issues matter to him? Very nice. So any other further comments or questions? Okay, I'm going to close the informational hearing on lawn irrigation requirements under homeowners associations and open an informational hearing on updates to the skiing activity statute. And with that, let's have Representatives Buehler and Johnson present, and then... Yeah, so I see that, and...
You're not skiing, man. Yeah. It's all about you today.
I see four for you. Yeah.
I'll get started. For the record... I am Mark Johnson from Hood River. I represent House District 52. That last topic worked up a thirst.
I know, I actually. For the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, for giving us a chance to present to you today on a very interesting topic. As I said, I represent House District 52, and obviously we have a lot of recreational interests out in the Gorge and Mount Hood. And this topic was brought to me by a couple of our ski areas who were talking about who knew that in statute there's actually language that talks about skiers and appropriate behavior while you're skiing. How many skiers actually up? Anybody skiers or snowboarders on the panel? Okay. Let me just read you a sentence here and see what this means to you. and see if you are aware that this actually is in Oregon, or these are in, this is in statute. It says skiers must wear retention straps or other devices to prevent runaway skis. Anybody skied long enough to remember the old ski straps?
Right,
Victoria,
so.
Thank you. Yes. Did you know that if you use ski straps at a ski area right now, they'll probably show you your way to the car, because those are not approved devices to prevent runaway skis anymore. We now have ski brakes, okay? Ski straps are ancient history. You can't use them anymore on a ski resort. But that's an indication of how long it's been since we've updated the language in here surrounding appropriate skier behavior on ski slopes. It actually dates back to 1979. So, yeah, and I don't know how many of you were around. Obviously, you were around Representative in 79, as I was, too. But what we didn't have in 1979 was snowboarding.
I'm mentioning the rest
right?
of us.
There weren't terrain parks in 1979. And the appetite for skiers' activities and what entails a successful ski day on the slopes is vastly different than it is right now. So that's why there's a need to statutorily upgrade and update the language that surrounds the skier code of conduct. So that's my interest in here. I was approached by Mounted Meadows, by Timberline, by Ski Bowl, which are all in my district. Representative Bueller here obviously represents Central Oregon, and they have some very wonderful resorts there as well. So that's really what, in a nutshell, is what entails this LC, is just an update of the skier code for the benefits of both the skiers and the lift operators and so forth in the ski areas themselves, because it's in everybody's best interest that we clarify what the rights and the responsibilities are to make sure that everyone can have an opportunity to have a safe and fun day anytime that you go to the slopes to engage in snow sports and snow-related activities. So with that, I'll pass off to Representative Bueller and allow him to make some statements. And we've got some very, very prominent ski representatives from the state behind this, and they can certainly delve into this issue much deeper than us.
Thanks, Mark. For the record, my name is Representative Newt Bueller from House District 54, which serves most of the city of Bend, which I'm sure many of you know. The ski industry is really key to that region. It is safe to say it's really driven and the creation of a very vibrant community. And we know the industry is important for its own economic impact. A substantial number of people come to Central Oregon just to participate at Mount Bachelor and also Hoodoo, which is not too far away from Bend. But I also want to draw your attention to the other impact that it has, a broader impact to the community, and that is it introduces literally tens of thousands of people to Oregon and to Central mm-hmm. Oregon. So these are destination places, and they're also destinations in many times rural areas. So people wouldn't necessarily come to these communities, come to these regions. And the nice thing is they come to these areas and they say, wow, this is actually a good place to live. You know, I never thought about coming to Oregon. And as we look back and do studies of why there has been so many people wanting to move to Central Oregon, their first introduction to the area many times is simply coming to ski at Mount Bachelor for a few days. Mm-hmm. So this industry not only is good for Oregon and the regions that they're located for the tourism, for the direct impact of their industry, but also to introduce people to Oregon and to the region, which we think is a big driver of the economic a positive economic climate in Central Oregon. And the final thing that you may not realize that they do is they substantially increase and enhance the quality of life. I mean, it is really nice for people to be able to have an afternoon to take off and go up to these resorts, and that also encourages people to move there, to move their businesses there, because it is such a nice feature of living in some of these areas in rural Oregon. So there's experts here on the industry. I'd like them to have time to share their experiences and why this is so important. But one final comment I'll leave you with, and something we encountered in the long session last time. I think it really behooves us as legislators, and maybe particularly in this committee, how important important it is to go back and look at some of these old statutes and old regulations that are literally 40 years old and just are not pertinent anymore or just don't have the intended effects. And I think we touched upon that a little bit last time, but I think this just highlights how much our laws and administrative rules become outdated. No one's going back through and culling through those regulations. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, first up we'll have Matthew Drake and John Constam. Well, just because we only have three chairs up here, so we'll kind of do panels of two, and after that will be David Rathbun and John Gifford, and then Arthur after that, if you want.
Good afternoon, Chair Fagan, commissioners. It's a pleasure to be here in Salem this afternoon. My name's Jeff Constam.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's okay.
Oh.
I live in Government Camp, and I'm the second-generation president and area operator of Timberline Lodge. I'm here to provide testimony in support of updating the skier activity statute. I'll describe how our sport has evolved over time and stress that our skier activity law needs to be updated to clearly represent the current realities of the sport. Inaction will result in lawsuits which could undermine the viability of an otherwise sustainable industry, an industry that drives local and regional economies and is a large part of a healthy and highly desirable lifestyle that is Oregon. We began operating Timberline in 1955. We had the original Magic Mile chairlift. It was a single chair. It probably had an uphill capacity of around 200 skiers an hour, and it took 20 minutes to ride. It had a single start button and a single stop button. We did have snowcats, but none of them were equipped with blades for plowing snow and other implements for grooming snow. Our customers were a hardy few. They, for the most part, understood the mountains and the risks associated with skiing. In the 1960s, skiing hit the mainstream. It became popular with a larger portion of our society and grew quickly. The growth actually saved historic Timberline Lodge. The economic engine of that is what the reason it's still there today, and really good management, of course. And it also spurred winter recreation-oriented economic activity that was really unprecedented in the state of Oregon. Mount Bachelor was developed, I think, in 1962, and Mount Hood Meadows in 1967. We also had new visitors to our industry with less experience. At the same time, civil court cases throughout the country were underscoring the obvious inherent risks of the sport and detailing personal responsibilities of users. In 1979, Oregon passed a law defining some of those at that time. In 1979, the sport was far different than it is today. Snowboarding had not become vogue, or came into vogue. There were no terrain parks or half pipes. Snowmaking did not exist in Oregon, and ski equipment you would hardly recognize today. The original Magic Mile chairlift is actually the second chairlift built in the country, was replaced in 1962 with a modern chairlift, and replaced again in 1992 with an even more modern chairlift. The most recent sits four people, has an uphill capacity of over 10 times the original, and takes 6 minutes to ride. It's monitored and driven by sophisticated computer systems and has numerous and redundant safety systems. Our modern snowcats are low emission, snow moving, and grooming wonders that provide a product on the hill that our customers demand. Ski and snowboard equipment is far more user friendly than it used to be, and teaching techniques have new participants proficient much sooner. Our customers are also demanding man-made terrain, features to ride and enjoy. This aspect of our sport is one of the new key developments that has allowed the industry to stay relevant with youth, and youth is the future of our sport. Like any hospitality business, we're driven by our customers. Their satisfaction is paramount to our mission. Improving safety through technology, training, and communication have all been hallmarks of our industry. We do not take the issue of safety lightly, and will always want to minimize what is an inherently risky activity. Currently, we represent an enormous asset to the state of Oregon. Our industry is an economic driver in rural areas and a leader in sustainability, tourism, workforce training, and workforce satisfaction, as well as managed outdoor recreation opportunities for our citizens. Statewide, we generate about $500 million in economic impact a year and employ around 7,000 Oregonians. Our sport, equipment, customers, and their expectations have all changed since 1979. Today, we need a skier activities law that properly reflects the reality of the sport. We need to be able to have an agreement with our users that outline each other's responsibilities and describes the inherent risks that exist today. Costs at ski areas will rise dramatically, and certain businesses may not be viable if they are open to lawsuits resulting from situations arising out of the result of the inherent risk of the sport. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions? Or?
Well, we'll just do the whole panel and then
okay.
We'll ask questions.
Good afternoon, Chair Fagan and committee members. Thanks for staying late on a Friday afternoon. It's been reported that the ski industry in Oregon does some of its finest work about this hour of the day. My name is Matthew Drake. I'm the chairman and CEO of Mountain Meadows, Oregon, LLC in Cooper Spur Mountain Resort. My dad, Franklin Drake, started our humble company, which has been growing significantly since 1967, in that year. As with the entire ski industry in the Northwest, the safety of our guests and employees at Mountain Meadows and Cooper Spur Mountain Resort is our number one priority. In fact, part of our core values as a company is safety and responsibility to all who work and recreate within our resort network. We have developed and continue to support a team of professional and highly trained patrol and safety specialists who are on staff, and we have a very proactive safety training program throughout our company that is heavily administered. As mentioned in previous presentation by Jeff, the evolution of the ski industry over the last 37 years has necessitated the update of the 1979 Oregon Skiers Activity Statute. My comments now will focus on the freestyle terrain safety, which is part of the update on the inherent risks mentioned in the statute. From the inception of ski resorts to as recently as the 1980s, generally, jumping and any kind of aerial maneuvers were banned in special use permit areas like Mountain Meadows, Timberline, and other areas in the state, and really throughout the United States. By the 1990s, because of snowboarding's accelerated growth, which, as Jeff mentioned, was really a salvation to many ski resorts, including ours, most resorts were providing snow features specifically catering to the new market demand. Today, most resorts offer freestyle terrain with a variety of difficulty levels. Freestyle terrain is an outdoor recreation area containing terrain that allows skiers and snowboarders to perform tricks, jumps, and other maneuvers with the aid of on-mountain features. The roots of freestyle terrain are in skate parks like in downtown Portland, Clackamas County, etc. Bend has a few. And many of the features are common to both skate parks and terrain parks at ski resorts. Resort personnel use industry best practices when building, inspecting, and maintaining freestyle terrain. Building snow features takes skill, knowledge, and experience that is gained from educational programs specific to freestyle terrain, and these programs are offered by the Pacific Northwest Ski Areas Association, the National Ski Areas Association, and camps like Cutter's Camp, which is held annually at Timberline Lodge. A great camp. One of many best practices of these terrain parks and the construction, design and construction of them includes features that are built in a way so that skiers and riders can actually go around the feature if they so choose. Additionally, ski areas provide user education, which initiates with initiatives such as Smart Style, which is a collaborative effort of NSA, Burton Snowboard Company, and the Professional Ski Instructors of America. These initiatives apply a code of conduct in freestyle terrain. The elements of this code encourage participants to make a plan, look for others before using the jumps or the features, respect other participants, and to participate at their own level of skill. Individual ski areas also use signage that alerts skiers and riders that they are entering freestyle terrain. Resorts provide user and information on their websites regarding this terrain and these features on a consistent basis as well. While the resort focuses on safety as it builds and maintains the freestyle terrain features, it has no control over the skier or snowboarder's use of that terrain. Therefore, it is incumbent on the user to be responsible and accountable for their own safety when using these features. This means following the industry codes, respecting signage, using features within their own level of ability, and be in control and use appropriate speed when using a feature. In closing, updating the 1979 Oregon Skiers Activities Statute to reflect current industry activities and practices will provide more accurate and specific definition and clarity of responsibilities for skiers, snowboarders, and ski area operators in general, and specifically for freestyle terrain. The update is good public policy to enhance the experience of all who work and ski and snowboard at Oregon ski areas. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Representative McLean?
I think it's always a good idea to update everything, but everybody has a purpose for why they, you know, want to have something done. So the clarity that you're asking for is to make sure that people who ski in your facilities understand their personal responsibility. Is that pretty much?
I think that's Representative McLean. That's just one aspect of the update. As Representative Johnson articulated, there are several elements to the 1979 statute which are no longer relevant,
okay,
or there are omissions from that statute that have now been developed since 1979.
Okay.
Snowboarding really, it became popular about 79, 1980. It was being done at other resorts in the Northeast as early as 1974. But when the statute was created, and Jeff and I actually remember that, it was to create at the time clarity to something that was completely undefined. So it was almost a starting point, and it was a good one. And it has served us pretty well up until now. And one can say, well, really, it's kind of been outdated for 30 years. But now is the time really to update it and, you know, get something that we all can live with.
Okay.
Any further questions? Okay. Thank you, gentlemen, very
much.
Thank
you. Thank you.
And let's have Dave Rathbun and John Gifford.
Sit next to each other. Good afternoon, Chair Fagan, the committee members. My name is Dave Rathbun. I'm the president of Mount Bachelor in Bend. Founded in 1958, actually, to correct my illustrious partner ahead of me. I've been in the ski industry for over 30 years. I've worked in Vermont at one place called Stratton Mountain, which was arguably one of the founding locations for snowboarding. And I've also worked in Colorado at two major resorts there prior to being here in Oregon for the last 8 years. I'm also here to testify on the importance of updating Oregon's skiing activities statute. As you've just heard, safety is the primary focus for ski area operators, and our industry has been a leader in the recreation industry in adoption of proactive safety measures and programs. Oregon ski areas, including Mount Hood Meadows, Mount Ashland, Timberline, and Mount Bachelor, have been recognized by the National Ski Areas Association for industry-leading safety initiatives through the association's annual Resort Safety Awards, representing its 325 member ski areas. What I'd like to talk about today are two specific situations that have evolved in our sport over the past few years that highlight the need for updating the skiing activity statute. Snow movement and its contribution to the risks of avalanche and what is called tree well immersion. Modern ski equipment developed over the last 15 years has allowed skiers of nearly all ability levels to explore more of our mountains, similar to what Representative Johnson was talking about with safety straps. If you remember what skis looked like 15 or 20 years ago, they were very long, very narrow, not exactly made for navigating deep snow. If you go look at the modern ski equipment, it's a little bit shorter, but much wider. So even large people like myself can get on a pair of skis and go through very deep snow and explore far more of our resorts than people would have done comfortably in the past. You don't float on that old equipment, and that's what that equipment that was around when the original Ski Safety Act was written typified. It's time to take a look at what that equipment has done to change the way our guests interact with the mountain and navigate that deep snow. Ski areas perform routine mitigation work to reduce the risk of avalanches within our ski areas. However, in light of the more and more skiers exploring all of these vast areas of our terrain, it simply is impossible to eliminate the potential for snow movement, either triggered by the skiers or from natural occurrences, such as when wind loading and the sun comes out and changes the temperature and the density of the snow. That's when the snow becomes unstable, and that's when you can have slides. Anything on an incline is susceptible to having a slide in the right conditions. Likewise, tree well immersion, something you may have been hearing about in the press lately, especially up in the Washington ski areas. When you ski near the base of a tree surrounded by deep powder snow, where the skier can fall in and then be covered by the snow around that tree well. That's what tree well immersion is all about. There are literally millions of trees on Oregon ski areas, and our guests are again increasingly seeking to explore off the groomed trails. To eliminate the risk of tree well immersion is simply not practical in practice. Safety is every ski area operator's top priority. However, these two situations of snow movement, we believe, should be clearly defined as inherent risks in an updated skiing activity statute. They didn't exist. They were not the prevalent issues in 1979, and they have become very, very important issues to address moving forward. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Fagan and committee members. My name is John Gifford. I'm the president of the Pacific Northwest Ski Areas Association. The association is a nonprofit trade group representing interests of winter recreation resorts in Washington, Oregon, Idaho, Alaska, Montana, and Northern California. On behalf of the Oregon resort members, I want to thank you for your interest in hearing this particular legislation that's being proposed. As you've heard from the three operators, this is a very important change that needs to be made in a 37-year-old statute. As you've heard, there's been a lot of changes. In addition to some of the that have been mentioned, ski conveyances. Terminology in the existing statute doesn't cover some of the conveyances that are now used, and it has some conveyances in it that are no longer used. So, again, another reason to be looking at why this law needs to be updated after 37 years. The proposed updates would establish in law appropriate terminology, definitions, and responsibilities of the ski area operator and the skiing and snowboarding participant, bringing the statute to the reality of what it is today. In the last few years, there have been similarly outdated statutes that have been adopted by other states where they have updated their older statutes. I'm going to give you two examples of nearby states. One is Idaho. The legislature there passed updates in 2014 to their 1979 ski statute. Included in that were providing broad protections to Idaho ski resorts when guests are injured in terrain parks or in inbounds avalanches. Expanded the state's definition of skier to include person using snowboarding equipment in freestyle terrain. Also added a provision that states that skiers expressly assume the risk and legal responsibility for injuries resulting from any movement of snow, including but not limited to slides, sloughs, and avalanches, and provides ski areas protections from injuries resulting from tree wells, snowmaking mounds, and injuries in terrain parks. Montana statute was originally enacted in 1971, has been updated several times since then, but the latest one was in 2015, where they included a definition of inherent dangers or risks and risks of skiing, so that it now includes any accumulation of snow around near trees or snowmaking equipment, and avalanches as an inherent risk of skiing. As you've heard, safety is a priority in the industry, and it's important that the statute be current so that participants and operators understand their responsibilities in the effort of being safe on the mountains. Starting this fall, we have had several meetings with the Oregon Trail Lawyers Association to work on language for these updates so that it is agreeable to both parties. We have made progress. There is still work to be done. And we have an agreement. We will continue working on that. Both organizations find that this is an important issue and feel that there is probably compromise we can reach.
All right, thank you. Questions?
I have one.
Representative McClain?
So to your last statement.
Which one?
The statement that you are still working together, right, and trying to integrate both of the concerns to make sure that the skiers understand their responsibility and it's clear, but that you also, as managers of properties and managers of places or destinations, have responsibilities.
Right.
So you're trying to meet that right, guideline for both.
Right.
So what are we going to be voting on then? Are we voting on that compromise eventually?
Eventually. Okay. Yeah, that's the objective,
so,
yes.
So 2 weeks from now, there'll be a compromise, is what
well,
you're saying?
Well, we hope so.
Okay, good.
That's what we're working towards.
Yay, okay.
I can't guarantee it, though. but that's what our focus is.
Okay.
Any further questions or comments? Okay, thank you, gentlemen. And finally...
Yeah, thank you for taking a Friday afternoon.
No problem. Arthur Towers. You get to be our last speaker. You're the speaker between all of us and a hearty Friday night dinner. So what do you got for us?
Chair Fagan, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Arthur Towers with the Oregon Trail Lawyers Association. I had the privilege of also being the last witness in the Senate Judiciary Committee meeting that ended a couple hours ago. Lucky them. I did want to come speak about this because this is an intriguing issue. The idea that we could do something here to make the Oregon ski industry the safest ski industry in America is really appealing to us, because our members are about consumer safety, about being consumer watchdogs, and that's the role that we're playing here. Last session, we had 11 meetings on this topic with the industry, and so far as Mr. Gifford mentioned, we've had 5 hours of meetings here in the interim on this topic, and the meetings have been cordial, but I don't want to sugarcoat it either. You know, we haven't reached a compromise yet. Maybe there's one there, maybe there isn't. I don't want to commit to the committee that we're going to get there or not, but we have invested the time to see if we can't do something here. And again, the meetings have been cordial and positive, but, you know, I just can't promise that. In the past, we have found compromise in other settings. You know, just this last session, we came before this committee last May with another rural-oriented economic driver, the agritourism industry. And we were able to, you know, in that situation, it was the same thing. I didn't think we would find a compromise, and then we did. And so that's what gives me hope here. We found a compromise in that situation where the rights and responsibilities of the profit-making entity were laid out, as were the rights and responsibilities of the consumers. And if the corporation's negligence caused injury, then they were held accountable. And so I feel like there might be a similar compromise here, perhaps, because we want to make sure that if a consumer is injured, they deserve the right to make their case. And I would say that a snowboarder or skier with me on their jury would have a tough time because of the inherent risk of that crazy sport. And so I do think that it is tough to make the case, but if the corporation you know, has improper staffing, improper training of their staff, improper jump design, improperly maintains their equipment, has man-made obstructions too close to ski runs. There are certain things they ought to be doing to be on the safe side and make sure that skiers are as safe as they can be, given the risk of the sport. This is another industry, just like agritourism, that markets to kids. Now, agritourism, like skiing, in my opinion, has a great deal more inherent risk than the hayride does. But the logic of this is pretty similar, in my opinion. And so, again, I think that there may be a spot where we can compromise, but I just don't want to guarantee it this afternoon. But I really have gained a lot of respect for the industry's representatives. They've come forward. They keep banging away. They make good cases. Updating the statute, there's parts that need updating. I mean, that makes some sense. But again, we want to make sure that families' rights are protected against negligent actions of these corporations when they exist. Let me just close and that I do respect these corporations' commitment to safety as well. No doubt about that. So I don't want to leave the impression I think that they're cowboys out there or anything like that. But again, if you are negligent and you do something wrong, it's only fair that you're held accountable. So with that, I'll close my remarks and happy to answer questions.
Any questions for Mr. Towers?
I know you don't want me to ask one, but I just have one.
Death stare.
We can't legislate a person's right away. I mean, so I just think that I just want you guys to remember to come together because we want everybody to understand what their responsibilities are. And there's no way that we're going to vote to take a person's right away to go to court and say, hey, look, I was hurt. So we just need to make sure we know what everybody's responsibility is.
Chair Fagan, Representative McLean, thank you.
Okay.
Any other comments or questions?
I got plenty of comments, but I'll withhold them.
Thank you.
Yeah, I was not going to yield to you for comments. Okay, with that, thank you, Mr. Towers. With that, I will close the informational hearing on updates to the ski activity statute. Anything else for the good of the order? All right, and with that, I will close the informational hearing of the House Interim House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Effectiveness. Have a one committee on Consumer Protection and Government Effectiveness.